The young railroaders slash tales of adventure and ingenuity, Francis Lovell Coombs, Roman 14, The Last of the Freight Thieves. "No, I'm not after you this time," laughingly, responded Detective Boyle to Jack's half-serious inquiry on recognizing his visitor at the station. One evening a month later, as the road detective who, on the previous memorable occasion, had called in company with the sheriff. "Instead, I want your assistance. Do you know," he asked, seating himself, "that your friends the freight thieves are operating again on the division?" "No," said Jack in surprise. "They are, and they have evolved some scheme that is more baffling even than the haunting trick you spoiled for them here last spring. Every week, they are getting away with valuable stuff from one of the night freights between Claxton and Eastfield, while the train is actually en route, apparently." "That sounds incredible, I know, but it is the only possible conclusion to come to, since the train does not stop between those places, and I made sure the goods each time were aboard when it left Claxton." Jack whistled. "That does look a problem, doesn't it? But where do I come in, Mr. Boyle? Last evening, while thinking the matter over, the trick the thieves used here at the junction recurred to me, the man shipped in a box. It came to me, why couldn't that same dodge be played back against them in this case?" "Oh, I see, have yourself shipped in a box and stolen by them? Clever idea," exclaimed Jack. "Not so bad, I think myself. Well, in the country, between Claxton and Eastfield, where it is my theory, the gang has its headquarters, there are no telephone or telegraph lines, and it struck me it would be a good plan to take someone along with me who, in case of things going wrong, could make his way back to the railroad and cut in on the wire and call for help. And naturally, you were the first one I thought of. Do you want the job?" asked the detective. "I'd jump at the chance," Jack agreed eagerly. "It'd be more fun than enough. But Mr. Boyle, how do you know that the boxes are taken to the freight thieves' headquarters unopened and not broken into right at the railroad?" "I figure that out from the number and size of the packages they have taken each time, just a good load for a light wagon. And anyway, you can see that that would be their safest plan if they broke up boxes. Near the track, they would leave clues that would be sure to be found sooner or later and put us on their trail. Through a friend in the wholesale dry goods business at Claxton, who I'll see down there tonight," the detective went on, "I can make practically sure of our being stolen together. The thieves have shown a partiality for his goods, and by having our boxes attractively labeled silk and placed just within the car door, there will be little chance of the robbers passing us by. My plan is to bring it off tomorrow night. Would that suit you?" concluded the detective. "Yes, sir. That is, if I can get away. For it will take all night, I suppose." "Yes, there will be no trouble about your getting off, though. I spoke to Alan before I came down," said Boyle, rising. "All right, it is arranged. You take the 5:30 down tomorrow evening with the necessary instruments, and I'll be at the station to meet you. Good night." As Boyle had promised, Jack had no difficulty in arranging to be off duty the following night and early. That evening, he alighted from the train at Claxton to find the railroad detective awaiting him. "The instruments, eh?" queried Boyle, indicating a parcel under Jack's arm as they left the station. "Yes, sir, and I have some wire and a file in my pocket. That's the ticket, and everything here is arranged nicely. We will head for the warehouse at once." "Here, the other bolt of silk, Mr. Brooke," the detective announced a few minutes later as they entered the office adjoining a large brick building. "All ready for us?" "A Chen, he's a pretty small bolt, isn't he?" commented the merchant, eyeing Jack with some surprise. "A trifle, but he makes up for size and quality," declared the detective, while Jack blushed. "He is the youngster who solved the ghost riddle and spoiled this same gang's game at Midway Junction." The merchant warmly shook Jack's hand. "I'm glad to meet you, my boy," he said. "After that, I can readily believe what Boyle says. Yes, I am all ready. This way, please," he requested. Following the speaker, Jack and the detective found themselves in a large shipping room. As they entered, a workman with a pot and inkbrush in his hand was surveying lettering he had just completed on a good-sized packing case. "Here are the goods, Judson," announced the merchant. "All ready, sir," the workman responded, eyeing Jack and the detective curiously. "Did you substitute boards with knot holes?" Mr. Brooke asked. "Yes, sir, and this is the door," said the man, indicating two wide boards at one end. "I used both wooden buttons and screw hooks on the inside, as you suggested." "Good." The detective examined the box. "You've made a good job of it," he commented. "I suppose this is the boy?" he added, turning to a smaller box on which also were the words, "Silk valuable." With lively interest, Jack examined the case. "Get in and let us see how it fits," suggested the merchant. Jack did so. "Fine," he announced. "I could ride all night in it, easily, either sitting or lying down curled up on my side." Detective Boyle glanced at his watch. "You may As well stay right there, Jack, he said. We will start just as soon as the wagon is ready. It's ready now. Judson, go and bring the dray around, the merchant directed. As the man left, the detective produced and handed Jack a small pocket revolver. Here, take this, Jack, said he. I hope you'll not have to use it, but we must take all precautions. Now to box you in. So saying, the detective fitted the door of Jack's box into place, and Jack, on the inside, secured it with the hooks and wooden buttons and announced, okay, the detective then entered his own box and with the merchant's assistance, closed the opening. As he tested it, there was a rattle of wheels without and the big door rumbled, open. A few minutes later, the two boxes of valuable silk had been slid out onto the truck and the first stage of the strange journey had begun. As planned, it was dusk when the two boxes reached the freight depot. The station agent himself met them. Everything okay, Boyle? He whispered. Okay, place us right before the door with the lettering out, the detective directed. The agent did as requested and with a final good luck, closed and sealed the car door just as the clanging of a bell announced the approach of an engine. A crash and a jar told the two unsuspected travelers that their car had been coupled. There was a whistle, a rumble, a clanking over switch points, and they were on their way. The wheels had been drumming over the rail joints for perhaps half an hour, and the disappearance of the light which had filtered through the car door had announced the fall of darkness when there came a screeching of brakes. Where do you suppose we are now, Mr. Boyle? Asked Jack from his box. It's the grade just north of Axford Road. When we hit the upgrade 2 miles beyond, we may begin to expect something. It was along there I figured that the... What's that? Both listened. One of the brakemen, isn't it? Suggested Jack. What is he doing down on the edge of the car? Roof. The next sound was of something slapping against the car door. Suddenly, the detective gave vent to a cry that was barely suppressed. Jack, I've got it. I've got it at last, he whispered, excitedly. The freight thieves have bought up one of the brakemen. He lets himself down to the car door by a rope, opens it, and throws the stuff out. Jack's exclamation of delight at this final revelation of the heart of the mystery was followed by one of consternation. But won't we get an awful shaking up if we're pitched off, going at full speed? He said in alarm. We may, we'll have to take it. It's all in the game, you know, declared Boyle grimly. Sit tight and brace hard, and it'll not be so bad, though. SH, here he is. There was a sound of feet scraping against the car door, a rattle as the seal was broken and the clasp freed, then a rumble and the sudden full roar of the train told the two in the boxes that the door had been opened. Swinging within, the intruder closed the door behind him and lit a match. Peering from a knothole, Jack saw that the detective's guess was correct. It was a brakeman. As Jack watched, the man produced and lit a dark lantern and turned it on the cases before him. Jack held his breath as the light streamed through the cracks of his own box. Just to order, muttered the brakeman audibly. And the bigger one, too. I'll not have to haul any out. Then, to Jack's momentary alarm, then amusement, the man seated himself on the box above him. Presently, as Jack was wondering what the trainman was waiting for, from the distant engine came the two long and two short toots for a crossing, and the man started to his feet, with his eye to the knothole. Jack watched. Again came a whistle and the creaking of brakes. Immediately, the brakeman slid the car door back a few inches, flashed his lantern 4 times, muffled it, and ran the door open its full width. The critical moment had come. Gathering himself together, Jack braced with knees and elbows. The trainman seized the box, swung it to the door, and tipped it forward. The next instant, Jack felt himself hurled out into the darkness. For one terrible moment, he felt himself hurtling through space. Then came a crackle of branches. The box whirled over and over again, plunged downward, and brought up with a crash. A brief space, Jack lay dazed in a heap, head down, but he had been only slightly stunned and recovering. He righted himself and found with satisfaction that he had suffered no more than a bruise of the scalp and an elbow. He had not long to speculate on his whereabouts. From near at hand came a sound of breaking twigs and a voice. The next instant, Jack felt himself hurled out into the darkness. Here's one, it said. Only with difficulty did Jack avoid betraying himself. It was the voice of the man, Watts. What is it? Inquired a second voice. Through a crack, a light appeared. Silk, announced Watts. A good weight, too, he added, tipping the box. Catch hold. The packing case was caught up and rocked and jolted. Jack felt himself carried for what he judged a full quarter mile. As the men slowed up, a gleam of moonlight showed through the knothole, and peering forth, he discovered a tree-lined road and a two-horse wagon. Sliding the box into the rear of the wagon and, well, to the front, the men disappeared. The wait that followed was to Jack the most trying experience of the evening. Had the detective safely landed? Was there not a possibility of the larger box having been shattered, or sufficiently broken to reveal its true contents and disclose the plot to the freight robbers? And what then would be his fate? These and many other disquieting possibilities passed through Jack's mind, causing him several times. As the minutes went by to finger the hooks and buttons, which would permit of his escape, finally snapping, twigs, then heavy, stumbling footfalls allayed his anxiety, and the two men reappeared, staggering under the box containing the officer. With difficulty, the unsuspecting thieves raised the heavy packing case to the tailboard of the wagon. "It won't go in," said Watt's companion. "Push this way a little," Watts directed. "I can't, look out." There was a scramble, and the box crashed to the ground. At the same moment, came a muffled exclamation, and Jack caught his breath. Was it the detective? If so, had the others overheard it? With relief, however, he heard Watts, who apparently was the chief of the gang, call his companion, a mule, and order him to catch hold again. The box, this time, was successfully slid aboard, and at once, the two men climbed to the seat, and the wagon rumbled off as they rattled along over a badly kept road. Jack gave as close attention to the passing scenery as his limited view permitted, in order that he might be able to find his way back to the railroad if it should prove necessary. This did not promise to be difficult. On either side, the dim moonlight showed an unbroken succession of trees, and also that the robbers were continuing in one direction, apparently due south. For what seemed at least 2 miles, they proceeded, then appeared a small clearing, and with a quickening of the pulse, Jack felt the wagon slow up and turn. In, they were at their destination. A forbiddingly suitable place for its purpose it was. Standing out darkly on the crest of a rise 200 yards back was a low shanty-like house in which appeared a single gleam of light. Between to the road stretched a desolate moonlit prospect of stumps, decaying logs, and brush piles. On either side, the woods formed a towering wall of blackness. Rocking and pitching, the wagon made its way up a rutty corkscrew lane. They reached the house, and the door opened, and a tall, unpleasant-looking woman appeared and greeted the men. "Good luck, eh?" she remarked briefly. "Sure, don't we always have good luck?" responded Watts. "Is supper ready?" "Yes, you uns better come in before you opens them boxes," said the woman. "All right." Passing on, the wagon came at last to a halt before a good-sized barn. The two men leaped to the ground, and while one of them opened the large side doors, the other proceeded to back the wagon to it, as the two freight thieves then unhooked and led their horses to the stable. There came to Jack's ears a welcome tapping. "Are you all right, lad?" whispered the detective. "Yes, okay, sir, though a bit nervous," Jack acknowledged. "Keep cool, and we'll soon have them where we want them. As they are going into supper first, we'll not leave the boxes till then. That'll give us just the opportunity we want to look around and arrange things nicely. SH, here they come." "Catch hold," said Watts. Jack heard the detective's box slide out and up from Watts, the staggering steps of the men across the barn floor, and a thud as the box was dropped. At what then immediately followed, Jack for a moment doubted his senses. It was the voice of Watts, saying quietly and coldly, "Now, my clever friend in the box, kindly come out." They had heard Boyle's exclamation when the box had fallen. Scarcely breathing, Jack listened. Would the detective give himself up without a? There was a muffled report, instantly a second, louder than silence. "Will you come out now?" demanded Watts. To Jack's horror, there was no response. Watts repeated the order, then called on his companion for an axe, and there followed the sound of blows and splintering wood. "Now haul him out." Terror-stricken, Jack listened. Suddenly there came the sound of a scramble, then of a terrific struggle. The detective was all right. It had been only a ruse. Uttering a suppressed hurrah, Jack began hurriedly undoing the fastenings of his door to get out to the detective's assistance before he had opened it. However, there was the sound of a heavy fall and a triumphant shout from Watts. Promptly, Jack paused, debated a moment, and restored the fastenings. He would wait. Perhaps they would bind Boyle and leave him in the barn. A moment later, Jack regretted his decision. Through the knothole, he saw the detective led by his arms bound behind him, and one of the freight robbers on either side. The voices and footsteps died away in the direction of the house, and Jack fell to wondering what he should do. Before he had decided, he heard the voices of the men returning. Apprehensively, he waited. Had they any suspicion of his presence in the second packing case? While he held his breath and grimly clutched his revolver, they slid his box to the rear of the wagon, lifted it out, and deposited it on the barn floor. "To have a look at it, make sure it hasn't some livestock in it too," inquired the second man. Jack's heart stood still. "No, it's all right," declared Watts confidently. "We'll have supper first." And to Jack's unspeakable relief, they passed out and closed the barn door, listening until from the house had come the slamming of a door. Jack once more freed the fastenings within the box, slipped the board aside, again listened a moment, and crawled forth. As he stood stretching his cramped limbs, he glanced about. A tier of what looked like bolts of cloth in the moonlight beneath one of the barn windows caught his eye. He stepped over. It was silk, silk such as he had seen in the warehouse at Claxton. Instantly there came to Jack a startling suggestion, as quickly he decided to act upon it. They may never catch on, he told himself delightedly, and in any case it will give me a good start back for the railroad for help. Glancing from the barn window to make sure all was quiet in the direction of the house, he drew his box into the moonlight, took out the parcel containing the telegraph instruments, and proceeded to remove the hooks and buttons and all other signs of the door. Then quickly he filled the box with bolts of silk from the pile beneath the window. That done, he found a hammer and nails and muffling. The hammer, with his handkerchief, as quietly as possible nailed the boards into place. Triumphantly, he slid the box to its former position on the floor. I think that will fool you, Mr. Watts, he said, with a smile, and catching up the telegraph instruments. He turned to the door. On the threshold, he started back. The two men and two others were returning from the house. In alarm, Jack looked about for a way of escape. Across the barn was a smaller door. He ran for it, on tiptoe, darted through, and found himself in the stable. Passing quietly on to the outer door, which the cracks and moonlight revealed, he waited until the four men had entered the main barn, then slipped forth and, keeping in the shadows, ran toward the house. He saw the detective led by, his arms bound behind HIM. A beam of light streamed from one of the rear windows. Jack made for it and, cautiously approaching, peered within. The woman he had seen at the door was at a table washing dishes, her back toward him. And just beyond, facing him and bound hand and foot in a big armchair, was the detective. For some minutes, Jack tried in vain to attract the officer's attention. Then the woman obligingly stepped into the pantry with some dishes, and quickly, Jack gave a single tap on the windowpane. Boyle looked up instantly, started, smiled, then nodded his head in the direction of the railroad. Jack held up the parcel containing the telegraph instruments. The detective nodded again, and in a moment Jack was off. It was an exhausting run over the rough, little-used road, now darkened by the overhanging trees, but at length Jack recognized the point at which he had been carried from the woods, and turning in, soon found himself at the railroad. Hurrying to the nearest telegraph pole, he swarmed up to the cross tree and quickly filed through the wire on one side of the glass insulator. The broken wire fell jangling to the rails, connecting an end of the wire he had brought with him to the wire on the other side of the pin. Jack slid to the ground, made the connections with the instrument, and the relay clicked, closed. At once someone on the wire sent, "Who had it open? What did you say?" "Alex," exclaimed Jack, at once recognizing the sending, and was about to break in when the instrument clicked, "17 just coming CX. Claxton and 17, just what we want." Quickly interrupting, Jack sent, "CX, hold 17, hold her." Then to X, "This is Jack, Al. I'm in the woods about 4 miles from Claxton. We found the freight thieves, but they have Boyle prisoner. Ask the chief to have 17 take on a posse at CX and rush them here. I'll wait here and lead them back. If they are quick, they'll capture the whole gang." "Okay, okay, good for you," shot back Alex. The wire was silent a moment, then Jack heard the order, "Go on to Claxton as desired." 25 minutes later, waiting in the darkness on the track, Jack saw the headlight of the fast-coming freight. The engineer on the lookout discovered him, pulled up, and a moment after Jack was off through the woods, followed by two officers and several of the train crew. When they reached the farm, lights were still moving about in the barn. Stealthily, the party made for it and surrounded it. "How would you like to lead the way in, Jack?" whispered the sheriff as they paused before the door. "That would be only fair after the trick Watts played on you." Jack caught at the idea delightedly, and all being ready, boldly threw open the barn door and entered, with drawn revolver, followed by the sheriff. The four occupants were so completely taken by surprise that for a moment they stood immovable about a box of dry goods they had been repacking. "How do you do, Mr. Watts?" said Jack, smiling. "This is my friend the sheriff, and the barn is surrounded. I think you would be foolish not to give up." "Yes, hands up," crisply ordered the sheriff. And slowly the four pairs of hands went into the air, and the entire balance of the long successful gang of freight thieves were prisoners. It was Jack himself who rushed off to the house and freed Detective Boyle. A half hour later, with one of the robbers' own wagons filled with a great quantity of recovered stolen goods, the sheriff escorted his prisoners back to the railroad, and before daylight, they were in the jail at Eastfield. Jack received considerable attention because of his part in the capture, and the affair still forms one of the popular yarns among trainmen on that division of the Middle Western, Roman 15, the dude operator. Alex Ward, like most vigorous, manly boys of his type, had a fixed dislike for anything approaching foppishness, especially in other boys. Consequently, when on reporting at the Exeter office, one evening he was introduced to Wilson Jennings. Alex treated him with but little more than necessary courtesy. For the newcomer, an operator but little older than himself, was distinctly a dude, from his patent leather shoes and polka-dotted stockings to his red and yellow banded white straw hat. His carefully pressed suit was the very latest thing in light. Checked gray, he wore a collar which threatened to envelope his ears, and his white tie was of huge dimensions. Also, he possessed the fair pink and white complexion of a girl. Alex was not alone in his derisive attitude toward the stranger. Shortly following the appearance of the night chief, Mr. Jennings nodded everyone a good evening and departed, and immediately there was a general roar of laughter in the operating room. Where did he fall from? Whose complexion powder is he advertising? Did you get onto his picture socks? Were some of the remarks bandied about when the chief announced that the new operator was from the east and was being sent to the little foothills tank station of Bonepile? There was a fresh outburst of hilarity. Why, that cowboy outfit near there will string him up to the tank spout, declared the operator on whose wire Bonepile was located. It's the toughest proposition on the wire. On the quiet, that is just why Jordan is sending him, the night chief said. Not to have him strung up, that is, but to put him in the way of finding himself, so to speak. He'll certainly find himself there then, if there's anything left to find when the ranch crew get through, laughed the operator. I'd give $5 to see that show and walk back. At that, you might have to walk back if you wagered your money on the outcome, responded the chief more gravely, turning to his desk. Clothes don't make a man, neither do they unmake one. The dude may surprise us yet. Whether the outcome of his appointment to the little watering station was to be a surprise or no, there was no doubt of Wilson Jennings' surprise when the following morning he alighted from the train at Bonepile, and as the train sped on, awoke to the realization that he was entirely alone. Blankly, he gazed at the little red-brown dry goods box depot, the water tank, the hills to the west, and to north, south, and east. The limitless stretching prairie. He had never imagined anything like this when he had decided on giving up a good position in the east to taste some adventure in the great west. However, here he was, and picking up his two suitcases, the boy made his way into the tiny operating room and on into the bunk kitchen living room. Behind, for here, 100 miles from anywhere, the operator's board and lodging was provided by the railroad. Early that evening, Wilson was sitting somewhat disconsolately at the telegraph room window when he was startled by a loud whoop. There was a second, then a rush of hoofs, and a party of cowboys came into view. It was the welcoming committee of the Barrow Ranch, the outfit referred to by the operator at Exeter. With a final whoop, the cowmen thundered up to the station platform and dismounted. Muskoka Jones, a huge, heavily moustached ranchman over 6 feet in height, was first to reach the open window, diving. Within to the waist, he brought a bottle down on the instrument table with a crash. "Pardner, welcome to our city," he shouted. The response should have been instantaneous and hearty. Instead, there was a strange quiet. The following Barrows faltered and exchanged glances. Surely the Western had not at last fallen down on its first obligation at Bonepile, for since the coming of the rails, they had regarded the station operator as a sort of social adjunct to the ranch. Keeper of an open house of hospitality, their daily paper, the final learned authority on all matters of politics and sport. And if this latest change of operators had brought them, Muskoka spoke again, and the worst was realized. "Well, you gal-faced little dude," the cowman crowded forward and peering over Muskoka's bored shoulders, studied Wilson from head to foot with speechless scorn. Muskoka settled forward on his elbows. "Are you a real operator?" he inquired. In a voice that sounded foolish even to himself, Wilson responded in the affirmative. "Actual, real male operator?" The cluster of bronzed faces guffawed loudly. "But why don't play keards, do you?" Muskoka asked incredulously. "Now I bet you don't, or smoke, or chew, or any of them wicked. Here are some cigarettes," the other man left. Hopefully, the boy extended the package to have it snatched from his hand, scramblingly emptied, and the box flipped ceilingward. In falling, the box brought further trouble. It struck something on the wall, which emitted a hollow thud, and glancing up, the cowmen espied Wilson's new, brilliantly banded hat. In a trice, Muskoka's long arm had secured it. With the common inspiration, the cluster of faces withdrew. The hat sailed high in the air, there was an ear-splitting rattle of shots, and the shattered remnant was returned to Wilson with ceremony. "There, all proper millinery de la Bonneville," said Muskoka. "And don't mention it. Now give me that whitewashed fence you have, around your ears." The boy shrank farther back in, his chair then suddenly turned and reached for the telegraph key. In a moment the big cowman's pistol was out. "Back in your chair, give me that white fence," he commanded, trembling. Wilson removed his collar and handed it over. The cowman stepped back and calmly proceeded to shoot a row of holes in it. "There," he announced, returning it, "much better, that's Bonneville fashion. Put it on." Meekly Wilson obeyed, and the circle of cowmen roared at the result. "Now," proceeded Muskoka, "that coat of yours is nice, very nice, but I think it'd look better inside out, try it." Wilson again turned desperately toward the key. The cowman banged on the table with his pistol, and slowly the boy complied. And a few minutes after, on a further command, he emerged from the doorway in, shattered hat, perforated collar, ridiculously turned coat, and with trousers rolled to his knees. A spectacle that set the cowboys staggering and shouting about the platform in convulsions of laughter. In fact, the result was so pleasing that after enjoying it to the full, the ranchman decided to carry the hazing no further and only requesting of Wilson that he wave his hat and give three cheers for the citizens of Bonneville. They mounted their ponies and scampered away, hastening into the telegraph instruments. Wilson began frantically calling Exeter. Before X had responded, however, the boy paused and sat back in his chair, a new light coming into his eyes. "Yes, sir, I'll wager they sent them down here to do this," he said aloud. Suddenly he arose and began removing the turned coat. "I'll stick it out here for 2 weeks if they lynch me," declared the dude grimly. It was early Wednesday evening of a week later that the monthly gold shipment came down from the Red Valley mines. The consignment was an unusually large one, and in view of the youth of the new operator, the superintendent wired a request that Big Bill Smith, the driver of the mines express, remain at the station until the treasure was safely aboard. Train. On reading the message, however, Big Bill flatly refused. "Why, it's the night of Dan Haggerty. Dance," he pointed out indignantly. "Doesn't the superintendent know that?" "The superintendent didn't and didn't care," was the response to the wired protest. The driver was supposed to remain at all times. It was an old understanding. Understanding or not, Big Bill declined to remain and stormed out the door, announcing that he would get someone down from the Barrow Ranch. Half an hour later, Muskoka Jones appeared. "Good evening. I'm sorry it was necessary to trouble you, sir," apologized Wilson. "Good evening, Willie. Don't mention it," was the big cowman's scornful response. Then, having momentarily paused to cast a contemptuous eye over the lad's neat attire, he threw himself on the floor in the farthermost corner of the room and promptly fell fast asleep. Some time after darkness had fallen, the young telegrapher, dozing in his chair at the instrument table, was startled into consciousness by the sound of approaching hoofbeats. With visions of Indians or robbers, he sprang to the window to discover a dim, tall figure dismounting on the platform. In alarm, he turned to call the sleeping guard, but momentarily hesitating, looked again, the figure came into the light of the window, and with relief he recognized Iowa Burns, another of the Barrow cowmen. "Hello, kid," said the newcomer, entering. "Where, old Muskoke?" "Good evening, over there asleep, sir. I suppose you knew he was taking Mr. Smith's place guarding the gold until the train came in?" "Sure, yes, I was there when Bill come up." He crossed to the side of the snoring Jones and kicked him sharply on the sole of his boots. "Muskoke, get up," he shouted. "Here's something to keep out the chills." Again and more sharply, he kicked the sleeping man while the boy looked on, smiling. Suddenly, the smile disappeared and the lad's heart leaped into his throat. He was gazing into the black, round muzzle of a pistol, and beyond it was a face set with a deadly purpose. Instinctively, his staring eyes flickered towards the box of bullion. "Yep, that's it. But wink an eye again and why get it?" said Burns coldly, advancing. "Now, get back. They're up again the corner of the table and stand, so F. Anyone comes along, you'll appear to be leanin' there. Conversin'. Go on, quick." Dazed, cold with fear, the boy obeyed, and Iowa, producing a sheaf of hide thongs, proceeded to bind his arms to his side as the renegade tightened a knot securing the boy. Left leg to the leg of the table, Muskoka's snoring abruptly ceased and the sleeper moved uneasily. In a flash, Iowa was over him, pistol in hand. But the snoring presently resumed, and after watching him sharply, for a moment, Iowa returned to the boy. "Now move, remember, and I shoot," he repeated, warningly. "To make sure, I'm going to fix up that snoring idiot over there before I finish you. and don't you as much as shuffle your hoof. Recovering the bundle of thongs, he strode back to the sleeper. As previously, the man's back had been turned, Wilson had shot a frantic glance about him. In there, sweep his eyes had fallen on the partly open drawer. In the end of the table, immediately below his left hand and in the drawer, had noted the bowl of a pipe. At the moment, nothing had resulted, but as the renegade back was again turned, his eyes again dropped to the drawer, and a sudden wild possibility occurred to him. His heart seemed literally to stand still at the audacity, the danger of it. But might it not be possible? The light from the single lamp on the wall opposite was poor, and his left side thus in deep shadow. And his left hand, he tried it. Yes, though tightly bound. At the wrist, the hand itself was free. His first day at the station, the visit of the men from the ranch, Muskoka's contemptuous greeting, recurred to him. Here was his opportunity of vindication. With a desperate clenching of the teeth, the boy decided, and at once began cautiously straining at the thongs about his wrist to obtain the reach necessary. Finally, they slipped, slightly but enough. Carefully, he leaned sideways, his fingers extended. He reached. The pipe fumbled a moment and secured it. Burns was on his knees beside the unconscious guard, splicing a thong. An instant, Wilson hesitated, then springing erect, pointed the pipe stem, and in a voice he scarcely knew, a voice sharp as the crack of a whip, cried, "Hands up, Burns, I got you. Quick, I'll shoot." The renegade cowman, taken completely by surprise, leaped to his feet with a cry, without turning, his hands instinctively half-raised. "Quick, up, up," cried the boy, breathlessly. Critical instant, the hands wavered, then slowly, reluctantly, they ascended. For a moment, the young operator stood panting, but half believing the witness of his own eyes to the success of the stratagem. Then at the top of his voice, he cried, "Mr. Jones, Mr. Jones, Muskoka, wake up, wake up." Iowa, muttering beneath his breath, paused anxiously to watch results. "Muskoka, Muskoka," shouted the lad. The snoring continued evenly, unbrokenly. Iowa indulged in a dry laugh. "Save your wind, kid," he said. "I fixed a drink he took before he came down." At this news, the boy's heart sank. "But look here, kid." Iowa turned carefully, hands still in the air. "Look here, can't we square this thing up? You got the drop on me, okay, and with a blame little pea shooter," he added, catching a glimpse, as he thought, of the end of a small black barrel, but nevertheless continuing his attitude of surrender. "You got the drop, and you're a smart kid, you are, but can't we fix this thing up? You take half. Say, I'd be glad to let you in. Honest, and no, wouldn't ever think you was in the game. Come, what D.Y. say?" Though apparently listening, the young operator was in reality urgently casting about in his mind for other expedients. Obviously, it would be too dangerous to attempt to reach with the fingers of one of his bound hands the thongs holding his left leg to the leg of the table. He might reveal the pipe or drop it, and neither could he reach the telegraph key to get in touch with someone on the wire. And in any case, how could that help him? For the next train was not due for 2 hours, and it did not seem possible he could carry on his bluff that length of time. But think as he would, the wire seemed the only hope. Could he not reach the key in some way? The solution came as Iowa ventured a short step nearer and repeated his suggestion. At first sight, it seemed as ridiculously impossible as the bluff with the pipe, but quickly the boy weighed the chances and determined to take the risk. "Now, Mr. Iowa," he said, "you are to do just exactly what I tell you, step by step, so much and no more. If you make any other move, if I only think you are going to, I shall shoot. My finger is pressing the trigger constantly. And I guess you can see that, at this range, though my hold on the gun is a bit cramped, I could not miss you if I wanted to. Listen, now, you will come forward until you can reach the chair here by sticking out your foot. Then you will push it back along the table to the wall, and turn it face to me. Then you will sit down in it. After that, I'll tell you some more. Go ahead, and remember my finger always pressing the trigger." As Burns came forward, infinitely puzzled, the boy turned slowly so that the muzzle of the pipe continued to cover the would-be bullion thief. Gingerly, Iowa reached out with his foot and shoved the chair back to the wall, and turning, backed into it and sat down. With the shadow of a grin on his face, he demanded, "What next?" "Now slowly let your left arm down at full length on the table. Their hand is on the key, isn't it? Now," continued Wilson, who never for an instant allowed his eyes to wander from the man's face, "now feel with your fingers at the back of the key and find a screwhead standing up." "Which one? There are two or three," said Iowa craftily. "No, there are not. There's just one. And I give you three to find it," said the young operator sharply. "One, two. Oh, go on." "I got it," exclaimed Iowa angrily. "Below the screwhead is a binding nut. Loosen it and turn it leftwise. Found it. Now take hold of the screwhead again and turn it to the left. It turns free, doesn't it?" "Sure. turn it about 4 times completely around. Now, the binding nut again down the other way till it's tight, got it? Now hold your fingertips over the black button at the inner end of the key and hit down on it, smartly. There was a click. That's it. It has plenty of play, hasn't it? Works up and down about an inch, if that's what you mean, growled Iowa, still puzzled. But what? I'm going to give you a lesson in telegraphy and you are going to, Iowa saw and exploded. Well, of all the say, what do you think? All right. Sharply, bravely, though inwardly, steeling himself for catastrophe, the lad counted. 1, 2, again he won. Oh, go on, sputtered Iowa, through gritting teeth. And the boy resumed. Hit the key a sharp rap, pretty good. Now 2 raps, one right after the other. Good. Now, those are what we call dots. Remember, now press the key down, hold it for just a moment, and let it come up again. Very good. You would learn telegraphy quickly, Mr. Burns. That is what we call a dash. With the situation apparently so well in hand, Wilson was beginning almost to enjoy it. Now I'll have you do what I've been aiming at, and remember always, my finger is constantly pressing the trigger. Now then, feel just this side of the key button, below the little button of a lever, got it? Press it, from you. There was a single sharp upward click of relay and sounder. The key was open, ready for operation. Now listen, I want you to make the letter X, a dot, a dash, then 2 more dots right together, and keep repeating till I stop you. Still under the spell of the fancied revolver and the boy's unfaltering gaze, the renegade cowman obeyed. And the telegraph instruments clicked out a painfully deliberate but fairly readable X. It was an idle half hour, and when the dispatcher at Exeter heard his call, he glanced up from a magazine, listened a moment, and impatiently remarking, "Some idiot student," returned to his reading. But steadily, insistently, the repetition of X's continued, and at length he reached forward, struck open the key, and demanded, "Who? Sign?" Clumsily came the answer, "B. Bompel." Now what's happening down there? It doesn't sound like the new operator, either. The wire again clicked open, and slowly, in the same heavy hand, the mystified and then amazed dispatcher read, "HELP, HELD, UP, AFTER, GOLD, TIED, TOT, ABLE, GOT, DROP, ON, HIM, MAKING, HM, SEND, B." The dispatcher grasped his key. "Good boy, good boy," he hurled back. "Keep it up for 25 minutes and we'll get help to you. There's an extra. Engine at H, waiting for 92. I'll start her right down." And therewith he whirled off into an urgent succession of H's. But through young Jennings' strange feat in telegraphy, help was nearer even than the unexpected succor from Hillside. Despite the sleeping draft Burns had administered to Muskoka Jones, the unaccustomed clicking of the telegraph instruments had begun to arouse the big cowman. When finally in climax came the lightning whir of the dispatcher. Excited response, he gasped into consciousness, blinked, and suddenly found himself sitting upright, staring open-mouthed at the spectacle before him. The next moment, with a shout, he was on his feet, in the middle of the floor, and the nerve-strung boy had fainted, as the lad sank forward, his pistol fell from his hand and rolled into the light. From Burns came an inarticulate cry, his jaw dropped, his eyes started in his head. Muskoka halted in his stride, wet his lips, and muttered incredulous words of admiration and amazement. Then in a moment he had cut Wilson free and stretched him on the floor. It was Iowa broke the silence. Rising with compressed lips, he held toward Muskoka the butt of his pistol. "Here, shoot me with my own gun," he said hoarsely. "I deserve it," Muskoka considered. "No," he decided at length. "Leave your gun as a present for the kid," and, turning and indicating the door, "Git." Thus was it the young dude operator proved himself and came into possession of a handsome pearl-handled Colt's revolver, and early the following morning from a committee of the Barrow cowmen, headed by Muskoka Jones, a fine high-crowned, silver-spangled Mexican sombrero to take the place of the hat they had destroyed, and as a mark of esteem for the pluckiest little operator ever sent to Bonepile. More important still, however, the incident won Wilson immediate esteem at division headquarters, where one of the first of the operators to congratulate him was Alex Ward. XVI, a dramatic flagging. Since shortly following Jack Orr's appointment to Midway Junction, Alex had been agitating, as he called it, for his friend's transfer to the telegraph force at the division terminal. At length, early in the fall, Alex's efforts bore fruit, and Jack was offered and accepted the night trick at one of the big yard towers at Exeter. Of course, the two chums were now always together, and the day of the big flood that October was no exception to the rule. All afternoon, the two boys had wandered up and down the swollen river, watching the brown whirling waters almost bank high, and the trees, fences, even occasional farm buildings, which swept by from above, When 6 o'clock came, they reluctantly left it for supper and the night's duties. "Well, what do you think of the river, Ward?" inquired the chief night dispatcher as Alex entered the dispatching room. "It looks rather bad, sir, doesn't it? Do you think the bridge is quite safe?" "Quite. It has been through several worse floods than this. It's as strong as the hills," the dispatcher affirmed, despite the chief's confidence, however, when about 5 o'clock in the morning there came reports of a second cloud burst up the river, he requested Alex to call up Jack at the yard tower which overlooked the bridge and ask him to keep them posted. "Tell him the crest of this new flood will likely reach us in half an hour," he added, "and that by that time, as it is turning colder, there'll probably be a heavy fog on the river." 25 minutes later, Jack suddenly called and announced, "The new flood's coming. There is a heavy mist and I can't see, but I can hear it. Can you see it from up there?" Alex and the chief dispatcher moved to one of the western windows, raised it, and in the first gray light of dawn gazed out across the valley below, instead of the dark waters of the river and the yellow embankment. Of the railroad following it, winding away north, was a broad blanket of fog stretching from shore to shore, but distinctly to their ears came a rumble as of thunder. "It must be a veritable Niagara," remarked the chief with some uneasiness. "I never heard a bore come down like that before." "Here she comes," clicked Jack from the tower. They stepped back to his instruments. "Say," there was a pause while the chief and Alex exchanged glances of apprehension, then came quickly. "Something has struck one of the western spans of the bridge and carried it clean away." "No, no, it's there yet, but it's all smashed to pieces. Only the upper structure seems to be holding." Sharply, the dispatcher turned to an operator at one of the other wires. "McLaren 46 hasn't passed Norfolk." "Yes, sir, 5 minutes ago." A cry broke from the chief and he ran back to the window. Alex followed and found him as pale as death. "What's the matter, Mr. Allen?" he exclaimed. "Matter? Why, Norfolk is the last stop between that train and the bridge. She'll be down here in 20 minutes. And even if we can get someone across the bridge immediately, how can they flag her? In that wall of mist?" Hopelessly, he pointed where, on the farther shore, the tracks were completely hidden in the blanket of white vapor. "And there's no time to send down torpedoes." At the thought of the train rushing upon the broken span and plunging from sight in the whirling flood below, Alex felt the blood draw back from his own face. "But we will try something, we must try something," he cried. At that moment, the office door opened and Division Superintendent Cameron appeared. "Good morning, boys," he said genially. "I'm quite an early bird this morning, eh? Came down to meet the wife and children. They're getting in from their vacation by 46. "Why, Alan, what is the matter?" The chief swayed back against the window ledge. "One of the bridge spans has just gone," he responded thickly, "and 46 past Norfolk." The superintendent stared blankly a moment, started forward, then staggered back into a chair. But in another instant, he was on his feet, pallid but cool. "Well, what are you doing to stop her?" he demanded sharply. The chief pulled himself together. "It only happened this moment, sir. The man at the yard tower just reported. One of the western spans was struck by something. Only the upper structure is hanging," he says. "Can't you send someone over on foot with a flag or torpedoes?" "There are no torpedoes at the bridge house, and there's not time to send them down. As to flagging, look at the mist over the whole valley bottom," said the dispatcher, pointing. "Except directly opposite, where the wind between the hills breaks it up at times, the engineer couldn't see 3 feet ahead of him." The superintendent gripped his hands convulsively. Suddenly, he turned to Alex. "Ward, can't you suggest something?" he appealed. "You have always shown resource in emergencies." "I have been trying to think of something, sir, but as the chief says, even if we could get a man across the bridge, what could he do? I was down by the river yesterday morning and the haze was like a blind wall. Couldn't a fire be built on the tracks?" "Not quickly enough, sir. Everything is soaking wet." The superintendent strode up and down helplessly. "And of course it had to happen after the Riverside Park station had closed for the season," he said bitterly. "If we had had an operator there, we—" The interruption was a cry from Alex. "I've something oil," he dashed for the tower wire. What's that?" cried the superintendent, running after. "Oil on a pile of ties or anything, sir, providing or can get over the bridge," Alex explained hurriedly as he whirled off the letters of Jack's call. The official dropped into the chair beside him. "I-I-T-R," answered Jack. "Or have you any oil in the tower?" shot Alex. "No, but there's some in the lampshed just below. Look here, could you possibly get across the bridge? I might manage it. There is a rail bicycle in the lamphouse. If the rails are hanging together, perhaps I could shoot over with that." "Why?" 46 is due in 20 minutes, and apparently we have no way of stopping her except through you." "Why, certainly I'll risk it, but..." buzzed the sounder. I suppose the oil is to make a quick blaze to flag her? Jack added, catching Alex's idea. That's it. Make it just this side of the Riverside Park station. Okay, here goes. Good luck, sent Alex with a sudden catch in his throat as he realized the danger his chum was so cheerfully running. God help him, added the superintendent fervently. Jack in the distant tower took little time to think of the danger himself. Catching up a lantern and lighting it, he was quickly out and down the tower, steps and running for the nearby shed. Fortunately, it was unlocked. Darting in, he found a large can of oil. Carrying it out to the mainline track, he returned and hurriedly dragged forth the yard lamp man. Rail bicycle, a three-wheeled affair with the seat and gear of an ordinary bicycle. Swinging the little car onto the rails, he placed the oil can on the platform between the arms, swung the lantern over the handlebars, mounted, and was off, pedaling with all his might. As he speedily neared the downgrade of the bridge, approach, and the roar of the flood met him in full force, Jack for the first time began to realize the danger of his mission. But with grimly set lips, he refused to think of it and pedaled ahead determinedly. He topped the grade, and below him was a solid roof of mist, only the bridge towers showing. Apprehensively, but without hesitation, he sped downward. The first dampness of the vapor struck him. The next moment, he was lost in a blinding wall of white. He could not see the rails. On he pedaled with bowed head. Suddenly came a roar beneath him. He was over the water. Jack's occasional views from the tower had shown him where the bridge was shattered, and for some distance, he continued ahead at a good speed. Then, judging he was nearing the wrecked portion, he slowed down and went on very slowly, peering before him with straining eyes and listening sharply for a note in the tumult of water below which might tell of the broken timbers and twisted iron. It came, a roar of swirling, choking, and gurgling. Simultaneously, there was a trembling of the rails beneath him. He was on the shattered span. At a crawl, Jack proceeded. The vibration became more violent. On one side, the track began to dip. Momentarily, Jack hesitated and paused. At once came a picture of the train rushing toward him, and conquering his fear, he went on. Suddenly, the track swayed violently, then dipped sharply sideways. With a cry, Jack sprang off backwards and threw himself flat on his face on the sleepers. Trembling, deafened by the roar of the cataract, just beneath him, he lay afraid to move, believing the swaying structure would give way every instant. But finally, the rails steadied and partly righted, and regaining his courage, Jack rose to his knees and began working his way forward from tie to tie, pushing the bicycle ahead of him. Presently, the rails became steadier. Cautiously, he climbed back into the saddle and slowly at first, then, with quickly increasing speed and rising hope, pushed on. The vibration decreased, the track again became even and firm. Suddenly, at last, the thunder of the river passed from below him, and he was safely across. A few yards from the bridge and still in the mist, Jack peered down to see that the oil can was safe. He caught his breath. Reaching out, he felt about the little platform with his foot. Yes, it was gone. The tipping of the car had sent it into the river, as the significance of its loss burst upon him, and he thought of the peril he had come through to no purpose. Jack sat upright in the saddle, and the tears welled to his eyes. Promptly, however, came remembrance of the Riverside Park station a mile ahead of him. Perhaps there was oil there. Clenching his teeth and bending low over the handlebars, Jack shot on, determined to fight it out to the finish. Meantime, at the main office, the entire staff, including the superintendent, the chief dispatcher, and Alex, were crowded in the western windows, watching, waiting, and listening. Shortly after Alex had announced Jack's departure, a suppressed shout had greeted the tiny light of his lantern on the bridge approach, and a subdued cheer of good luck had followed him as he had disappeared into the wall of mist. Then had succeeded a painful silence, while all eyes were fixed anxiously on the spot opposite where a light west wind, blowing down through a cut in the hills, occasionally lifted the blanket of fog and dimly disclosed the river bank and track. Minute after minute passed, however, and Jack did not reappear. The silence became ominous. Surely he should be over by this time, and we should have had a glimpse of his light, said the chief. Unless an electrifying cry of "There he is," interrupted him, and all momentarily saw a tiny twinkling light and a small dark figure shooting along the distant track. A moment after, the buzz of excited hope as suddenly died. From the north came a long, low-pitched "Too-oo-too-oo-oo-oo," the train. How far up, Alan? 3 miles, the superintendent groaned. He'll never do it, he'll never do it. She'll be at the bridge in 5 minutes. Jack rose to his knees and began working his way forward from tie to tie. No, Broad is careful, declared the chief, referring to the engineer of the coming train. He won't keep up that speed when he strikes the worst of the fog. There are 8 or 10 minutes yet. Again came the long, mellow notes of the big engine, whistling a crossing. "Who's that?" said Alex suddenly, half turning from the window. The next moment, with a cry of, "He's at the station, Orr's at the park station," he darted to the calling instruments and shot back an answer. The rest rushed after and crowded about him. "I'm at the park station," whirled the sounder. "I broke in. I lost the oil can on the bridge. There is no oil here. What shall I do?" As the chief read off the excited words to the superintendent, the official sank limply and hopelessly into a chair. "But might there not be some there somewhere? Who would know, Mr. Allen?" At Alex's words, the chief spun about. "McLaren, call Flanagan on the phone," he cried. "Quick!" The operator sprang to the telephone, and in intense silence the party waited. He got the number. "Hello, is Flanagan there? Say, is there any oil across the river at the park station? For heaven's sake, don't ask questions. Is there?" "Yes, he says there's a half barrel in the shed, behind," reported the operator. Alex's hand shot back to the key. At the first dot, he paused. Through the open window came a whistle, strong and clear. The chief threw up his hands. Alex himself sank back in his chair helplessly. Suddenly, he again started forward. "I have it." With the sharp words, he again grasped the key, and while those about him listened with bated breath, he sent like a flash, "Jack, there's a barrel of oil in the shed at the rear. Knock the head in, spill it, and set a match to it. Burn the station." The chief and the operators gasped, then with one accord set up a shout and darted back for the windows. The superintendent, told of the message, rushed after. In absolute silence, all fixed their eyes on the spot. A mile up the river where lay the little summer depot, once more came the long-drawn two, ooh, for a crossing. "The next'll tell," said the chief tensely. "For the crossing this side of the station, or," it came. It was the crossing. But the next instant from the mist shot up a lurid flare. From the windows rose a cry. Higher leaped the flames, and suddenly across the quiet morning, air came a long series of quick sharp toots. Again, they came, then the short, sharp note for brakes. With the sharp words, he again grasped the key, and the boys and the flames had won. The superintendent turned and held out his hand. "Ward, thank you," he said huskily. "Thank you, you are a genuine railroader." "And about the station?" queried Alex, a sudden apprehension in his face and voice. For the moment. The crisis was past. He had realized with dismay that he had issued the unprecedented order for the burning of the station entirely on his own responsibility. "The station?" The superintendent laughed. "My boy, that was the best part of it. That was the generalship of it. There was no time to ask, only act. The fraction of a second might have lost the train." "No, that is just why I say you are a genuine railroader. The burning of the station was a piece of the finest kind of railroading." "And this reminds me," added the superintendent, some minutes later, leading Alex aside and speaking in a lower voice. "We expect to start construction on the Yellow Creek branch in 6 weeks, and we'll be wanting an advance guard of 3 or 4 heady, resourceful operators with the construction train or on ahead. Would you like to go? And your friend? Or there'll be plenty of excitement before we are through." "I'd like nothing better, sir, or either, I know," declared Alex with immediate interest. "But where will the excitement come in, sir? You have heard the talk of the K and Z also running, a line to the new gold field from Red Deer, and that they were held up by right-of-way trouble? Well, we have just learned that that was all a bluff, that they have been quietly making preparations and are about to start construction almost immediately, and you see what that means? A race for the Yellow Pass. A race, and more than that. Did you ever read of the great war between the Santa Fe and the Rio Grande for the Grand Canyon of Colorado? Regularly, organized bands of fighting men on either side and pitched battles. Well, I don't anticipate matters coming to that point between us and the K and Z, but I wouldn't be surprised if it came near it before we are through. The lines traverse wild country, and the K and Z people have men in their construction department who would pull up track or cut wires as soon as light a pipe. In the latter case, they would cut at critical times. There is where an operator with a head for difficulties might prove invaluable. I would be more than glad to tackle it, sir," agreed Alex enthusiastically. "Very well, then, you may consider yourself and your friend Orr appointed. And if you know of anyone else of the same brand, you might suggest him," the superintendent concluded. "I don't think I do, sir, at the moment," Alex responded. The week succeeding brought Alex a suggestion. Roman 17, Wilson again, DISTNGUSHES himself. It was decidedly warm the following Monday noon at Bonepile, and Wilson Jennings, his coat off, but wearing the fancy Mexican sombrero that the Barrow cowmen had given him, sat in the open window. to catch the breeze that blew through from the rear, from the window Wilson could not see the wagon trail toward the hills to the west. Thus was it that the low thud of hoofs first told him of someone's hurried approach. Starting to his feet, he stepped to the end of the platform. At sight of a horseman coming toward him, at full speed and leading a second horse, saddled but riderless, Wilson gazed in surprise. Wonder increased when, as the rider drew nearer, he recognized Muskoka, Jones, the big Barrow cowman. "What is it, Muskoka?" he shouted as the ponies approached. The cowpuncher pulled up, all standing within a foot of the platform. "There's been an explosion at the Pine Load, kid, and 10 men are bottled up somewhere in the lower level. 2 men got in through a small hole, the mouth of the mine is blocked, and one of them is tapping on the iron pump pipe. Bartlett, the mine boss, thinks it may be telegraph ticking, that maybe Young knows something about that. Will you come up and listen? You see, if they knew what was what inside, they'd know what they could do. They are afraid to blast the big rock that's blocking the mouth for fear of bringing loosened stuff down on the men who have been caught." Wilson was running for the station door. "I'll explain to the dispatcher," he shouted over his shoulder. "IIX," responded the dispatcher. "There has been an explosion at the Pine Load mine," sent Wilson rapidly, "and a man has been sent to take me there to try and read some tapping from the men inside. Can you give 144 and the mail clearance from Q and let me go up? Some tapping? What? Oh, I understand." "Okay, go ahead," ticked the dispatcher. "Get back as soon as possible." "I will." "All right, Muskoak," cried Wilson, hastening forth, struggling into his coat as he ran. "Get round, Thar," shouted the cowboy, swinging the spare pony to the platform. Wilson went into the saddle with a neat bound. "Say, you've seen a hoss before, kid," observed Muskoak with surprise as he threw over the reins. "Sure I have. Used to spend my summer vacations on a farm. Can ride a bit standing up," said Wilson with pride. They swung their animals about together and were off on the jump. As the two ponies stretched out to their full stride, the cowboy eyed Wilson's easy seat with approval. "Well, kid," he observed after a moment. "Silence, next time I come across a dude, I'll get him to do his tricks before I brand him. I don't see but what you sit about as good as I do." Wilson's pleased smile gave place to gravity as he returned to the subject of the explosion. "When did it happen?" he asked. "Early this morning. Just after the men went in, they're not sure, but think it was powder stored at the foot of the shaft down to the lower level. The main lead of the Pine Load, you know, runs straight into the mountain, not down, and the shaft to the lower level is a ways in. We heard the noise at the Barrow. There's nothing much to see or do, though," the cowman added as they raced along neck and neck. "A big rock just over the entrance came down, and when they got the dirt away, they found it had bottled the thing up like a cork. It's that they are afraid to blast until they know how the men are fixed inside. Hoover and Young got in through a small hole at the top, Hoover about half an hour before Young. He started tapping on the pipe too, then stopped. They don't know what happened to him. 20 minutes hard riding brought them to the foothills. Still at the gallop, the ponies were urged up a winding rocky trail and finally a tall black chimney and a group of rough buildings came into view. There it is," said the cowboy, indicating a ledge. Just above, as they went forward, still at full speed, Wilson gazed toward the mine entrance with some astonishment. Mine disasters he had always thought of as scenes of great excitement. People running to and fro, wringing their hands, excited crowds held back by ropes and men calling and shouting. Here about, a spot but little distinguished from the rest of the rocky, sparsely treed mountainside, was gathered a group of perhaps 50 men, some sitting on beams and rocks, others moving quietly about, all smoking. On their being discovered, however, there was a stir, and as Muskoka and the boy dismounted at the foot of a rough path and ascended, there was a general movement of the miners and cowmen to meet them. "I got him," Muskoka announced briefly to a grizzle-haired man who met them at the top. "This is Bartlett, the mine boss," he said to Wilson by way of introduction. The boss nodded. "The tapping's going on yet, is it, Joe?" "No. It stopped just like Hoover's did," was the gloomy response. "And just when we were getting onto it ourselves." The speaker held up a small board penciled with figures and letters. "Reading their hit on the idea that maybe Young was knocking out the numbers of letters in the alphabet, and we made this table and just found out we had it right when the tapping stopped. That was 20 minutes ago, and we haven't had another knock since. Let's see it. What did you get?" "There, 27-5-20-21-16-TGETUP. Something about can't get up, we figured it, but it's not enough to be of any use. And there's not another man here can wriggle in through the hole," went on the boss, turning toward the great rock which sealed the mouth of the mine. "A dozen of them tried it and Redding got stuck so, we had to get a rope on him. nearly pulled his legs off. Wilson made his way forward and examined the strangely blocked entrance. The small hole referred to was a triangular-shaped opening about a foot in height and some 16 inches in width, apparently just at the roof of the gallery. Some minutes Wilson stood studying it, pondering. Finally, he turned about with an air of decision and returned to Muskoka and the mine boss. "I have a plan," he announced. "If you will go back to the station again, Muskoka, I'll send for another operator and go in the mine myself." Two operators could talk backwards and forwards easily on the piping and, "But where's the other operator?" interrupted the cowb. "There is a freight due at the station in about 25 minutes. I can give you a message to hand the engineer for the operator at Ledges the next station, a message asking the dispatcher to send the Ledges operator down on the mail. Someone could wait for him, and if there is no hitch, he'd be here inside of an hour and a half." "That'll work," exclaimed the boss. "That's it, you'll go, Muskoka." "Certainly, I'll get a fresh hoss and wait for him myself." Wilson, finding an envelope in his pocket, dropped to a boulder and began writing. "WBJ Exeter," he scribbled. "Am at the mine. The tapping has stopped. No one else can go in, so I am going myself. Please send down operator from Ledges to read my tapping if I am unable to return. Jennings." "Reading, war's red," shouted Muskoka as he folded the message. "Here, what?" "I'm going back to the station for another operator. I'm going to take your Johnny Hoss. Mine's blowed." "Sure, yes," agreed the owner, and with a good luck kid, Muskoka was clattering down the path. "Now, Mr. Bartlett, will you please explain the plan of things inside, just how the tunnel runs?" requested Wilson. "Have a seat and I'll draw it," said the boss, setting the example. He turned the board bearing the fragmentary message, and Wilson dropped down beside him. "The main gallery, the old lead, runs straight in. At about this dip down," he said, drawing as he spoke, "runs back 550 feet and ends. That was where the old lead petered out. Here, about 200 feet from the entrance, is a vertical shaft 90 feet that we put down to pick up the old pine knot lead. It's from the foot of that the new gallery, the lower level, starts. It slopes off just under the old lead, so 330 feet, there's a fault in it. Cants up 12 feet, so, then on down again at a bit. Sharper dip, nearly 600 feet, then another fault and a drop, and about 50 feet more. It's down there at the end we think most of the men have been caught, but some may have been near the shaft. The pumping pipe where Hoover and Young must have been tapping is here, halfway between the first and second faults where it comes down, through a boring from the old gallery. It must have been at that point because we had disconnected two leaking sections just below there only this morning. How do you get down the shaft to the lower level? Wilson asked. There was a ladder, but it was smashed by the explosion. Hoover, the first man in, came out for a rope, so I suppose that's there now. Young must have gone down by it. Hoover also reported that the roof of the old gallery was in bad shape just over the shaft. That's the particular reason we are afraid to blast the rock here, until we know whether any of the men were caught at the bottom of the pit. Wilson arose and began removing his collar. How about water, Mr. Bartlett, since the pump is not working? He inquired. Unless the explosion tapped new water, there'll be no danger for 24 hours at least. But if the drain channel of the lower gallery has been filled, the floor will be very slippery, the mine boss added. It's slate, and we left it smooth as a runway for the ore boxes. As the young operator removed his spotless collar, one similar to that which had so aroused the cowman, derision on his first day at Bonepile, without a smile, one of the very men who had formed the welcoming committee that day rubbed his hands on his shirt, took it carefully, and placed it on a clean plank. You'll want a lamp. Somebody give the boy a cap and lamp, the boss directed. A dozen of the miners whipped off caps with attached lamps, and trying several, Wilson found one to fit. Then, buttoning his coat and turning up the collar, he made his way to the rock-sealed entrance and climbed up to the narrow opening. I'll tap as soon as I reach the pipe, he said. So long. And without more ado, crawled headfirst within and disappeared, the lamp on his cap lighting up the narrow trough-like tunnel. Wilson easily wormed his way forward 10 or 12 feet. Then the passage contracted and became broken and twisted. However, given confidence by the knowledge that others had passed through, Wilson squeezed on. There presently came a widening of the hole, then a black opening, and with a final effort, he found himself projecting into the black depths of the empty gallery. Below him, the debris sloped to the floor. Pulling himself free, he slid and scrambled down and quickly was on his feet, breathing with relief. Only pausing to brush some of the dust from his clothes, Wilson hastened forward. 200 feet distant, a windlass took shape in the obscurity. He reached it, and the black opening of the shaft to the lower level was at his feet. Looking, He found the rope the mine boss had spoken of. It was secured to one of the windlass supports and disappeared into the depths on the opposite side of the pit. Directly below was the shattered wreck of the ladder. Leaning over, Wilson shouted, "Hello, hello!" The words crashed and echoed in the shaft and about him, but there was no reply. Once more he shouted, then resolutely suppressing his instinctive shrinking, he made his way about to the rope, carefully lowered himself, and began descending hand under hand. Wilson had not gone far when, with apprehension, he found the rope becoming wet and slippery with drip from the rocks above. Despite a tightened grip, his hands began to slip. In alarm, he wound his feet about the rope. Still he slipped. To dry a hand on his sleeve, he freed it. Instantly, with a cry, he found himself shooting downward. He clutched with hands, feet, and knees, but onward he plunged. In the light of his lamp, the jagged, broken timbers of the shoring shot up by him, he would be dashed to pieces, but desperately he fought, and at last got the rope, clamped against the corner of a heel, and the speed was retarded. A moment after, he landed with an impact that broke his hold on the rope and sent him in a heap on his back. Rising, Wilson thankfully discovered he had escaped injury other than a few bruises, and gazed about him. At first sight, he appeared to be in the bottom of a well filled with broken, water-soaked timbers and gray, dripping rock. He knew there must be an exit, however, and set about looking for it, at the same time listening and watching shrinkingly for signs of anyone buried in the heap of stone and timber. Not a sound save the monotonous drip of seeping water was to be heard, however, and presently behind a shield of planking, he located the black mouth of a small opening. Dropping to his knees, he crawled through and stood upright in a downward sloping gallery similar to that above the lower level. Once more he shouted, "Hello, hello!" Clashing echoes died away without response, and he started forward. Scarcely had he taken a half dozen steps when, without warning, his feet shot from under him and he went down on his back with a crash, barely saving his head with his hands. The smooth, hard rock was as slippery as ice from the water flowing over it. Wondering if this icy declivity had anything to do with the failure of Hoover and Young to return, Wilson arose and went on more cautiously. As he proceeded, the walking became more and more treacherous. Several times he again went down, saving himself by sinking onto his outstretched hands. On rising from one of these falls, Wilson discovered something which sent him ahead with new concern. A few yards farther, he halted with an exclamation on the brink of a yellow stretch of water that met the gallery roof 20 feet beyond him. Blankly, he gazed at it. Then he recalled the fault the mine boss had spoken of, an abrupt rise of the gallery 12 feet. This must be it. Its drain had choked and filled it with water, but both Hoover and Young had passed it. The pipe they had tapped upon was beyond. They must have waded boldly in, dove or ducked down, and come up on the other side. At the thought of following them in this, Wilson drew back. Had he not better return? Could he, though? Could he ascend a rope down, which he had been unable to prevent himself sliding? The answer was obvious. Desperately, Wilson decided to venture the water, to reach those he now knew were on the other side, and the pumping pipe. In preparation, he first securely wrapped the matches he carried in notepaper taken from an envelope and placed them in the top of the miner's hat. Then, removing his shoes to give him firmer footing, he stepped into the yellow pool and carefully made his way forward. 6 feet from the point at which the water met the top of the gallery, the water was up to his chin, and he saw he must swim for it and dive. Without pause, lest he should lose his nerve, he struck out, reached the roof, took a deep breath, and ducked down. 3 quick, hard strokes, and he arose, and with a gasp found himself at the surface again. A few strokes onward in the darkness, and his hands met a rough wall over which the water was draining as over the brink of a dam. At the same moment, a sound of dull blows reached his ears. Spluttering and blinking, Wilson drew himself up. A shout broke from him, far distant, and below was a point of light. "Hello," he cried. Immediately came a chorus of response, as though many were excitedly shouting at once. Unable to distinguish anything from the jangle of echoes, Wilson cried back, "Are you all safe?" Again came the clashing, incomprehensible shout. "I'm coming down," he called, though not sure that they heard him. Producing the matches from the crown of the hat, he found they had come through dry, and after some difficulty lighting one against the side of another, he relit the lamp. While at this, voices continued to come up to him, evidently shouting something, but try as he could, he was unable to make out what was said. It was all a reverberating clamor, as though 100 people were talking at once. As the lamp spluttered up after the ducking which had extinguished it, Wilson gazed down the gallery before him with a touch of new dismay. The water was flowing over it in a thin, glossy coat, and it was considerably steeper than on the outer side of the fault. Apparently, the only thing to do was to slide, working about into a sitting position, facing down, the slope with feet spread out as though steering a sleigh. Wilson allowed himself to go. The rapidity with which he gained momentum startled him. Soon, the gray damp walls were passing upward like a glistening mist. With difficulty, he kept his feet foremost. Meantime, the voices from below had continued, shouting. Onward he slid, and the sounds became clearer. At last, the words came to him. They were, the pipe. The pipe, catch the pump pipe. Then, Wilson suddenly recollected that the pipe was but halfway down the slope. Digging with his heels, he sought to slow up, gazing first at one flitting wall, then the other. On the right, a vertical streak of black appeared. He clutched with heels and hands and sought to steer toward it. He swept nearer and reached with outstretched hand. The effort swung him sideways, his fingers just grazed. The iron and twisting about, he shot downward head, first at greater speed than ever. A moment after there was a chorus of shouts, a sharp cry in his ears, an impact, a rolling and tumbling, a second crash, and Wilson felt himself dragged to his feet. About him, in a single flickering light, was a group of strange faces. While he gazed, dazed, rubbing a bruised head, all talked excitedly, even angrily. "Why didn't you hang on, you idiot?" demanded a voice. "Who is it, anyway? It's a stranger." "And a boy," said another. Wilson recovered his scattered wits and quickly explained who he was and what he had come for. Immediately, there was a joyful shout. "We'll be out inside of an hour," cried one. "But how am I going to get up to the pipe?" demanded Wilson. "We are cutting footholds up the incline." "White, get back on the job," directed the speaker, who Wilson later learned was the fire boss. "You brought him down with you," he added to the boy. The man spoken to began creeping up the water-covered slope, dragging a pick, and Wilson turned to look about him. The 11 men in the party, not including the man on the slope, were crowded together on the level floor of what evidently was the lower fault of the lead. From the darkness beyond came the sound of water trickling to a lower level. "Are all here and no one hurt?" he asked. "Hoover and Young and everybody and not one scratched," responded the fire boss. "You were the one nearest hurt. You were a mighty plucky youngster," he added, "to come through that water up there." Wilson interrupted a chorus of hearty assent. "What happened to Hoover and Young at the pipe?" he inquired. "That mystified everybody outside. They both caught it coming down, but Hoover lost his hold trying to change hands for tapping, and Young dropped the knife he was knocking with and slipped fishing for it," the fire boss explained. Meantime, at the entrance to the mine, a half hour, having passed without a knocking on the pipe to announce the arrival inside of the young operator, anxiety began to be felt for his safety also. When another half hour had passed and there was still no response to frequent tappings of inquiry, the mine boss, Bartlett, began to stride up and down before the blocked entrance. "I shouldn't have allowed him to go in," he muttered repeatedly. "He was only a boy." When at length Muskoka Jones reappeared on the scene, and with him the operator from Ledges, Bartlett, met them with a gloomy face. At that very moment, however, there was a shout from the men gathered about the pumping pipe. "He's knocking," cried a voice. Bartlett, Muskoka, and the Ledges operator went forward on the run. The latter dropped to his knees and placed his ear to the pipe. At the quick smile of comprehension which came into his face, a great cheer went up. It was immediately stilled by a gesture from the operator, and in tense silence he caught up a stone, tapped back a signal, then read aloud Wilson's strangely telegraphed words of the safety of the men below, their situation, and the means to be taken to reach them. And just at sunset, the bedraggled but joyful, cheering party of rescuers and rescued emerged from the entrance. Wilson to a reception he will remember as long as he lives. The most important result of Wilson's courage and resourcefulness, however, was an interview Alex Ward had that evening at Exeter with the division superintendent. Following a recital of Wilson's feat at the mine, Alex added, "You said last week, Mr. Cameron, that I might suggest a third operator for the Yellow Creek Construction Advance Guard of Operators. Like to suggest Jennings, sir." "He is appointed then," said the superintendent. "Go and tell him yourself." XVII, with the construction train on a newly made siding parallel to the main line tracks, and in the center of a rolling vista of yellow-brown prairie, stood a trampish-looking train of weather-beaten passenger coaches and boxcars. In the sides of the latter, small windows had been cut, and from the roofs projected chimneys. North of the train, to a din of clanking, pounding, and shoveling, a throng of men were laying ties and rails, driving spikes and tightening bolts in the construction of further short stretches of track. It was the Yellow Creek branch boarding and construction train, and the laying of the sidings of the newly created Yellow Creek Junction was the first step in the race of the Middle Western and the K and Z. some miles below the southern horizon for the just discernible. Break to the southwest in the blue line of the Dog Rib Mountains, the coveted entrance to the new gold fields in the valley beyond, and here, the first of the construction operators. Sent forward, Alex had been 2 days established in the telegraph car. As he had anticipated, Alex was enjoying the experience hugely. It was every bit as good as camping. Out, he had declared over the wire to Jack, having for an office a table at one end of the old freight car, sleeping in a shelf-like bunk at the other end, and eating in the rough-and-ready diner with the inspectors, foremen, timekeepers, and clerks who shared the telegraph car with him. As well, the work going on about him was a constant source of interest during Alex's spare moments. On this, the second day, Alex had been particularly interested in the newly arrived track-laying machine, which did not actually lay track at all, but by means of roller-bottomed chutes fed out a stream of rails and ties to the men ahead of it. After supper, the wire. Being silent, Alex made his way amid several trains of track material already filling completed sidings for a closer view of the big machine. There proved to be less to see than he had expected, and having climbed aboard the pilot car and examined the engine, Alex ascended the tower from which a brakeman controlled the movements of the train. On his right lay a string of flats piled high with timbers for bridges and culverts. Glancing along them, Alex was surprised to see a man's head cautiously emerge from an opening in the lumber on one of the cars and quickly disappear on discovering him. A moment after, he had a fleeting glimpse of the intruder, running low along the side of the train toward the rear. Only a hobo, Alex decided on second thought, for numbers of tramps had come through on the material trains, and presently Alex returned to the telegraph car. Shortly after midnight, the young operator was awakened by someone running through the car and shouting for construction superintendent Finnan when he caught the word fire. He scrambled into his clothes and leaped to the floor and out. Over the tops of the cars in the direction of the track machine was a dancing glare. In alarm, Alex joined the stream of men dropping to the ground all along the boarding cars. Dodging through the intervening trains, he brought up with an expression of relief beside not the track machine, but a car of bridge material. Fanned by a brisk wind, flames were spouting from amid the timbers at several points. Already men were pitching the burning beams over the side, however, and finding a shovel, Alex joined those who were smothering them with sand. Tramps, sure, Alex heard another of the shovelers remark angrily. Immediately then he recalled the man he had seen from the track machine, tower, and pausing in his work, he counted the cars back. It was the same car. Yes, undoubtedly the fire was the careless work of the tramp he had seen running away. The force of firefighters was rapidly augmented, and soon, despite the fresh breeze, the last of the burning beams were smothered and all danger of a general conflagration was past. It was as Alex at last headed back for the boarding train that a theory other than the tramp theory of the origin of the fire occurred to him. It came from a sudden recollection of Division Superintendent Cameron, prediction of interference from the K and Z. Could that be the real explanation? He asked himself, with some excitement. The first streak of dawn found Alex again at the scene of the fire, bent on proving or disproving the theory of incendiarism. Climbing aboard the scorched car, he dropped to his knees and began carefully brushing aside the sand with which the burning floor had been covered. A few minutes' search produced the burned ends of shavings. So, the fight is on, observed Alex to himself, gravely, with several of the telltale fragments in his pocket. Alex was about to leap to the ground when construction Superintendent Finnan appeared. Good morning, my lad. You beat me here, eh? He said genially. Well, what do you make of it? Alex sprang down beside him and produced the charred pine whittlings. I found these on the bottom of the car, sir. They don't seem to support the careless tramp theory, do they? Continuing, Alex then told of the man he had seen there the evening before. Do you think it was the work of the K and Z, sir? He concluded. The superintendent's lips were drawn tight. Yes, I believe it was. Could you identify the man? I am afraid not, sir. It was getting dusk, and he was 5 or 6 car lengths from me and running, stooped over. Perhaps we could follow his footsteps down the side of the train, Alex suggested. Good idea, lead ahead. There has been a good deal of tramping about, but we may pick them out. Proceeding to the point several cars distant at which he had seen the stranger on the ground, Alex moved on slowly, carefully inspecting the freshly turned but considerably trampled earth, the superintendent following him. A car length beyond, the latter suddenly paused, retraced his steps a few feet and pointing out 3 succeeding impressions, exclaimed, I think we have him, Ward C. A long step, he was running on his toes. Aided by the known length of the stride, they continued, following the footprints with comparative ease. Passing the second car from the end, they found the steps short, then changed to a walk. Probably turned in between this and the last car, the superintendent observed. Yes, here they go, announced Alex, halting at the opening between the two flats. He stood for a moment, then went on through. Alex and the superintendent followed and continued toward the rear of the last car. Halfway, Alex halted and with an ejaculation stooped and picked up something white. A small shaving, sir, the official took it. That decides the matter, he said. Probably it was sticking to his clothes. He sat down here for some time, did he not? Alex was pointing to a depression in the earth well, under the car, between two ties, and to the marks of Boothiel's. The superintendent went to his knees and closely examined the impressions left by the heels. Good. Look here, he said with satisfaction. The marks of spurs. Our tramp was a horseman. Alex turned to look about. Where would he have kept his horse? Superintendent Finnan led the way beyond the cars into the open, a mile distant and hidden from the boarding train by the cars on the sidings was a depression in the prairie bordered with low scrub. We'll have a look there, he said. Some minutes later, they stood in the bottom of the miniature valley beside the unmistakably fresh hoofprints of a hobbled pony. The official was grimly silent as they retraced their steps toward the construction train. They had almost reached it when Alex, who had been examining the fragments of burn shavings, broke the silence. Mr. Finnan, let me see the bit of shaving we found. By the rear car, please. There was a touch of excitement in Alex's voice and the superintendent halted. What is it? He asked as he produced the whittling. Alex glanced at it and, smiling, placed it beside two of the charred fragments in his hand. Look at these, little ridges, sir. The same knife whittled them all. The blade had two small nicks in it. All we have to do now, sir, is to find the owner of the knife. A bright idea, Ward, splendid, exclaimed the superintendent heartily. But, he added as they moved on, how are we going to find him? We can't very well round up the whole dog rib country and hold a jackknife inspection. They came within sight of the bleached out dining cars, basking in the morning sun on the steps of one. Of the old coaches was the figure of a young Indian, who had come from no one knew where the first day of their arrival and had attached himself to the kitchen department. Alex laid his hand on the superintendent's arm. Mr. Finnan, why not try Little Hawk? It occurred to me just as you spoke. I will right now. You go on into breakfast, Ward, he directed, and say nothing of our suspicions or discoveries. Very well, sir. The members of the telegraph car party were leaving for the diner as Alex appeared. Hello, Ward, catch the early worm? Inquired one of the track foremen jocularly. You mean, did he shoot it? Corrected a time clerk. At this, there was a general laugh and glancing. About for an explanation, Alex saw Elder, Superintendent Finnan's personal clerk and aide-de-camp, hastily remove a cartridge belt and revolver from his waist and toss them into his bunk. Elder was the one unpopular man in the telegraph car, an undersized, aggressively important individual, just out of college and affecting a stylish khaki, hunting suit, natty leather leggings, and a broad-brimmed hat. He bore himself generally as though second in importance only to the construction superintendent himself, and naturally he had promptly been made the butt of the party. But you know, gravely observed one of the inspectors, as they took their places about the plain board table in the dining car, some of these tramps are dangerous fellows. They'd just as soon pull a gun on you as borrow a dime. So there's nothing like being prepared, particularly when one carries about such evidence of wealth and rank as friend Elder here. At the chuckles which followed, the clerk bridled angrily. Well, anyway, Ryan, he retorted, I am ready to fight if one of them interferes with me. I'll not stick up my hands and let him go through me as you did once. Oh, you wouldn't, eh? No, I wouldn't. In fact, I'd like to see anyone make me throw up my hands even if I didn't have a revolver, Elder went on emphatically. I'd rather be shot. Yes, sir, I'd rather be shot than have to. Think afterward that I'd been such a weak-kneed coward, and that's what I think of any man who would permit a low-down tramp to go through his pockets. Loud applause greeted these remarks, clapping, banging of plates, and cries of hear, hear. Go it, Elder. Show him up. It's on me. He has me labeled, okay, admitted Ryan with marked humility. But then, gentlemen, I protest it is hardly fair to compare an ordinary mortal to so remarkably courageous a man as Elder. I claim it is not given many men to be that fearless. Why, with half an eye, as the old grammars say, you can see courage sticking out all over him. All right, laugh, but I never showed the white feather to a hobo, Elder repeated scathingly. No, but what is it Kipling or Shakespeare says, while there's life there's soap? Observed Ryan, a sudden twinkle appearing in his eye. The inspector explained the meaning of his facetiously garbled quotation when Elder left the table. The proposal he made was greeted with enthusiasm. Work had been started on the branch road itself that morning and on returning to the telegraph car at noon. The superintendent's clerk found most of the party there, before him, preparing for dinner. An animated debate, which was in progress, ceased as he entered, and someone exclaimed, "Here he is now. He'd soon straighten them up." "What is the trouble, men?" inquired Elder with the air of a sergeant major. "Our two head spikers had a disagreement this morning and have gone across the yards to settle it," explained one of the timekeepers through his towel. "Couldn't you go after them and interfere? They may put each other out of commission, refuse to listen to me or the foreman." "The childish idiots, certainly," agreed Elder, turning back to the door. "Which way did they go?" "Straight across the yard. But hadn't you better take your gun?" the time clerk suggested. "They are a pair of pretty tough customers." "Well, perhaps I had since you mention it," Elder responded. Going to his bunk, he secured and buckled on the belt, drew the revolver from its holster to examine it, and set forth grimly. As he disappeared, the men in the car broke into barely subdued splutterings of laughter, and crowding to the door, waited expectantly. With an air of responsibility and determination, the clerk made his way between the adjacent cars. There were six tracks filled with the long trains of construction material. He had passed the fifth and was stooping beneath the couplings of two flats beyond, when from the other side he heard footsteps. One hand on the butt of his revolver, he leaped forth. Uttering a choking cry, he sprang back. Within a foot of his eyes were the barrels of two big Colt's pistols, and looking over the tops of them was a villainous handkerchief-masked face. "Hands up," ordered the tramp hoarsely. Elder's hands flew into the air. Immediately, despite his fright, there returned a remembrance of his boast that morning. He half made as though to bring his hands down. Instantly, the cold muzzles of the pistols were pressed close beneath his nose. With a wild flutter, Elder's fingers shot upward to their fullest. "Stretch. Come out," ordered the tramp, quaking and almost on tiptoes in his effort to keep his hands aloft. Elder obeyed. Lowering one of the pistols and thrusting it into his belt, the tramp reached forward and secured the clerk's revolver, dropping it to the ground beneath his feet. "Now, Mr. Superintendent," he ordered gruffly, "hand over your roll." "Why, I'm not the superintendent," quavered Elder hopefully. "I am only a clerk." "Clerk nothing. Don't you think I know a superintendent when I see one? Out with those yellowbacks you drew yesterday, or by gum." The pistol was again thrust under his nose, and Elder blanched. "But I'm not the superintendent. Honestly, I'm not," he protested. "I'm only a clerk, and I only get. "Yes, come on." "You only get?" thundered the tramp. "I only get $35 a month," whispered the clerk. "Only 35 bones a month? Well, by gum." The tramp looked the shrinking clerk over with unspeakable contempt. "Why, there ain't a Dago shoveler in the outfit doesn't get more than that." "Very well, then," he conceded loftily. "You can keep your coppers. I never let it be said I rob the poor. But I tell you what I will have," he went on suddenly. "Them clothes are sure too good for any man not getting as much money as a Dago. These," indicating his own tattered and grimy garments, "are more in your line. Come on, peel off." The trimly dressed clerk stared aghast. "You surely don't mean?" "I surely do mean shell off," roared the tramp, and utterly beyond belief as it was 10 minutes. Later, Elder was surveying himself in the unspeakable rags of the hobo, and the latter before him was ridiculously attired in his own natty, smaller garments. Having then removed Elder's fancy Stetson and clamped his own greasy and battered Christie down to the clerk's ears, the tramp had one further humiliation. Pointing to a clump of black, oily waste hanging from a nearby axle box, he ordered, "Pull out a bunch of that." Slowly, wondering, Elder did so. "No one would believe you were a genuine hobo, with such a scandalously clean face as that. Rub the waste over it," commanded the tramp. This was too much. Blindly, Elder turned to escape. Instantly, both pistols were once more at his head, and in final abject surrender, he slowly rubbed the black car grease upon his cheeks. "Very good. A little on the forehead now," directed the relentless tramp. "Now the ears. Go on. Very good. Now you may go." Frantically, Elder spun about and dove between the cars. As he did so, behind him roared out six quick pistol shots. Blindly, he scrambled under the next train. Shouts rose ahead of him. "Help, help," he cried. "Tramps, tramps, help." From the boarding cars broke out a hubbub of excitement. "Tramps, tramps," he shrilled, scuttling. Beneath the third train on the other side, he suddenly pulled up. He had forgotten his outlandish appearance. What if men sprang into view from between the cars farther down? "Here he is," they shouted, instantly heading for him. "It's me, Elder," cried the apparent tramp. More men appeared. The tramp who burned the car, rose the cry. Lynch him, lynch him. Elder Dove back the way he had come. The trackmen raced for the nearest openings and Dove after, as Elder dashed for the next train several of his. Pursuers sprang into view but a car length away. Head him off, don't let him get away, they shouted. Madly Elder rushed on, darted beneath the last string of flats and on out into the open. A figure was approaching on horseback. He recognized Superintendent Finnan. Uttering a cry of hope, he headed for him. At sight of the desperately running figure with its grimy face and flapping rags, the superintendent pulled up in sheer amazement. When the stream of men broke through the train and poured, after yelping like a pack of hounds, he urged his horse forward. Catch him, stop him, shouted the pursuers. It's me, Elder, screamed the clerk. Elder, Elder. A big Irishman, a pick handle in his hand, was gaining on the supposed tramp at every bound, roaring, I'll fix ye, ye vermin. With a last desperate sprint, the flying clerk reached the horse and threw himself at the superintendent, stirrups. It's Elder, Mr. Finnan, he gasped. Elder, Elder. The superintendent gazed down into the blackened face an instant, then suddenly doubled up over his horse's head, rocking and shaking in a convulsion of laughter. The action saved the clerk from the Irishman. The descending pick handle halted in midair. The wielder gazed open-mouthed at the convulsed official, then suddenly grasping the clerk's head, twisted it about and staggered back, roaring and shouting at the top of his lungs. As fast as the others arrived, the riot of merriment increased. And when, presently, the superintendent moved on toward the train, the crestfallen clerk still at his stirrup, they were the center of a hilariously howling mob. The final blow came when Elder entered the telegraph car. Carefully laid out in his bunk were the garments he had surrendered to the tramp. The incident had its final good result, however. The mangling of Elder's vanity disclosed an unsuspected streak of common sense and manliness, and a day or so after, he frankly thanked Ryan, the perpetrator of the joke, for having put him right. And finally, he became one of the most popular men on the train, Roman 19, the enemy's hand again, and a capture. Good morning, Ward. Any word of the progress made by the K and Z? Inquired construction. Superintendent Finnan the following morning, Sunday, looking into the telegraph car. Alex threw down his towel and stepped to the instrument table. Yes, sir, here's one that came late last night. It says they started from Red Deer yesterday morning and made nearly 3.5 miles. The superintendent looked somewhat glum as he read the message. That beats us by 0.5 mile, he remarked. If the news is reliable, that is, they may plan to give out inflated distances in order to discourage us. That would be a small matter to them, after trying to burn us out. There has been no sign of Little Hawk yet, sir? Alex inquired. No, I am beginning to think the rascal has gone over to the K and Z, said the superintendent, turning away. At the door he paused. By the way, Ward, remind me to give you a message tomorrow morning asking for 2 more operators. We will have made 6 or 7 miles by Monday night and will be running the train down the branch. And the temporary station is almost completed, he added, glancing from the window toward a boxcar which had been lifted from its trucks and placed on a foundation of ties beside the mainline tracks. Alex promised gladly. It meant the coming of Jack Orr and Wilson Jennings. Following breakfast, the morning being a beautiful one, Alex determined on a walk and set off along the mainline to the west. 2 miles distant, he struck a small bridge and a deep, dry creek bed and, turning south along its border, headed for the distant railhead of the new branch. At a bend in the creek some 200 yards from the track machine and its string of flat cars, Alex sharply paused. 2 saddled ponies were hobbled together in the creek bottom. Casting a glance toward the construction train, Alex leaped into the gully out of sight. He had not a doubt that the horses belonged to men in the service of the K and Z, and that something was on foot similar to the attempted burning of the bridge car. What should he do? Return the 3 miles to the junction? Or continue on to the track machine? Four. Undoubtedly, the owners of the horses were there, and the machine, he knew, was in the sole charge of an oiler. Alex decided on the latter course and, making his way along the bed of the stream, past the hobbled ponies and onto the new bridge 50 feet in rear of the construction train. As he there halted, low voices reached Alex's ears. Peering cautiously out and seeing no one, he crept forth and made his way along the side of the embankment toward the train. A few feet from the rear, car Alex came upon a 3-wheeled track velocipede used by Elder, the superintendent's clerk, in running backwards and forwards between the railhead and the junction. Pausing, he debated whether he should not put it on the rails and make a run for the junction immediately. Finally, Alex concluded first to learn something further of what was going on and to count on the velocipede as a means of making his escape in case of emergency. To this end, he proceeded cautiously to place the little jigger in a position from which he could quickly swing it onto the irons. Then, continuing forward under the edge of the train, he reached the pilot car. "Yes, it's a first-class machine, the best on the market." The voice was that of the oiler. Apparently he had been showing the strangers over the track machine. For a brief space, Alex wondered whether, after all, his suspicions were justified. But at once came the thought, why had the strangers hidden their horses in the creek bottom if they were genuine visitors? And he remained quiet. "Where is the boiler?" inquired a new voice, evidently one of the owners of the horses. "There is none. The steam comes from the engine, behind," the oiler responded. "Here it comes in here. So, and does the machine get out of order very easily?" asked a second voice. There was something in the tone that caused Alex to prick up his ears. "Almost never. It's all simple. Nothing intricate," the man in charge replied. "I suppose it could be put out of order, though. Say, you fellows were to go on strike and wanted to disable things, eh? Huh, that's rather a funny question, but I suppose it could. Anything could, for that matter. What do they pay you as oiler? Say, what are you two fellows driving at?" the oiler demanded sharply. There was a momentary silence during which Alex imagined the two strangers looking questioningly at one another. Then one of them spoke. "Look here, whatever you get, we will give you $100 a month extra to put this machine out of order 2 or 3 times a week. Nothing very bad, but just enough to lose 2 or 3 hours work each time. We are, well, never mind who we are. The thing stands this way. We have a big bet on that. The K and Z will win in this building race for Yellow Creek, and well, you see the point, I guess. What do you say?" During the pause that followed, Alex waited breathlessly and with growing disappointment. Was the oiler considering the bribe? "Well," said the oiler at length, "is that your best offer? Couldn't you make it 1,000? 1,000? Nonsense. 2,000 then? What do you mean? Just this," cried the oiler, and simultaneously, there was a rush of feet and a sound of blows. Exultingly, Alex was scrambling forth to go to the oiler assistance, when just above him was a crash of falling bodies, and a figure bounded over the side of the car and rolled sprawling down the embankment. It was the plucky oiler, and Alex shrank back in horror as the man came to a stop flat on his back and lay immovable, blood trickling from a wound over his eyes. Overhead was the sound of someone getting to their feet. "He nearly got you," said a voice. "Nearly, but I guess I got him one better. Is he safe for a while, do you think?" As the two men moved to the edge of the car and apparently gazed down at the prostrate figure in the ditch, Alex shrank back with apprehension on his own account. "Perhaps we'd better make sure of him. All right, here is a bit of rope." Hurriedly, Alex crawled beneath the nearby truck. Behind the wheels and a tall figure in the garb of a cowboy dropped to the ground before him and ran down to the still unconscious oiler. Binding the prostrate man's feet together at the ankles, the cowman turned the oiler on his face and secured his hands behind his back. Turning him again face up, he studied his eyes a moment and announcing, "Good job, only stunned," he returned to the car and drew himself up on it. "Now what'll we do?" inquired his companion. "That idiot has knocked our plans to pieces. We can't go back and say we neither made the deal nor did anything else for our money. We'll have to tear things up ourselves," said the first man decisively. "Let us see what we can do in the engine room here." The footsteps passed into the engine house, and Alex at once crawled forth to make his way back to the velocipede. As he emerged from beneath the car, he paused to glance down at the prostrate oiler. Should he leave him lying there? It did not seem right, despite the obvious necessity of heading for the junction without a moment's delay. As he hesitated, the eyes of the prostrate man flickered and opened. Alex dodged back, lest the oiler should betray his presence to the men on the car. As he dropped down, there came the recollection that there were 2 seats on the velocipede. Why not take the man with him if he sufficiently recovered? Good. Anxiously, Alex watched as the stunned man blinked about him. Finally, comprehension, then a hot flush of rage appeared in the oiler's face, and with a violent kick, he twisted about toward the car. Springing into view, Alex caught the oiler's startled eye and made a warning gesture. The man stared dully for a moment, then nodded and on Alex. Further urgent signaling, dropped back and again closed his eyes. Alex produced and opened his jackknife. The men above were busily fumbling about in the engine room, only pausing to make sure they were entirely occupied. Alex slipped forth, cautiously crept down the embankment, reached the bound man, and with a slash of the knife freed his feet and hands. "Let us slip back to the velocipede. It's ready to throw on the rails and make a dash of it for the junction, Alex whispered. The oiler arose and with one eye on the engine room door, they crept up under the edge of the car and on toward the rear of the train. They reached the little track car and cautiously lifted it onto the rails. Better push it a ways, the oiler advised in a low voice. They might hear the rumble with our weight on it. Gently, they set the velocipede in motion. With the first move, one of the wheels gave forth a shrill screech. The two paused as the sounds on the pilot car immediately ceased. If we hear one of them going to the edge to look, for me, we'll make a run of it, said the oiler. They may go on tiptoe, Alex pointed out. The suggestion was followed by a sharp exclamation from the head of the train. The oiler's gone, cried a voice. Simultaneously, there was the sound of someone springing to the ground, and Alex and the oiler scrambled into the velocipede seats, Alex facing the rear, and threw themselves against the handles. The oilless wheel again screeched, and from the pilot car rose the cry, around at the end, quick. Alex and the oiler wrenched the handles backwards and forwards with all their might, and the little car leaped ahead. Before they had gained full headway, however, one of the machine wreckers appeared about the end of the train and, with a cry to his companion, dashed after. He ran like a deer and, despite the increasing speed of the velocipede, quickly gained upon them. He'll get us, Alex exclaimed. The creek bridge is just ahead. That'll stop him, said the oiler. The second man appeared and joined in the chase. The first runner saw the bridge and redoubled his efforts. In spite of their best endeavors, he drew rapidly nearer. A hand shot out to clutch the oiler's shoulder. It reached him, and with a rumble they were on, and over the bridge, and their pursuer had sprawled, forward flat on his face. He was on his feet again like a wildcat, however, and crossing the bridge three ties at a time, leaped to the flat ground beside the track and was again after the velocipede like a racehorse. Try as they would, Alex and the oiler could get no more speed out of the low-geared machine, and with alarm Alex saw the runner once more drawing near, the second man they had outdistanced. Closer the cowman came. Stop, he shouted. Stop, you may as well, I've got you. Determinedly they held on, working the handles, desperately Alex watching the grim, clean-shaven face and the fluttering dotted handkerchief about the pursuing man's neck with a curious fascination. At last he was parallel with them. Still running, he drew his revolver. Stop, he ordered. Stop, or I'll put one through you. Keep it up, boy, the oiler directed sharply. He daresn't fire, he daresn't add murder to it. And he'd be heard at the junction. The runner snapped his gun back into its holster and, putting on an extra spurt, rushed slanting up the embankment and threw himself bodily upon the oiler. They tumbled off backwards in a struggling heap. Throwing his weight against the handles, Alex stopped. The velocipede sprang off and dashed to the oiler's assistance. The cowman's revolver had fallen from his belt. Alex caught it up and pressed it against the back of the man's head. Stop it! Let go! He cried. I'll certainly shoot. The man half relaxed and glared up sideways. Alex brought the muzzle to his eyes, and slowly he freed his hold on the oiler. Oh, very well, he muttered with a curse. You win. No, don't, said Alex as the enraged oiler spun about to strike the half-prostrate man. He's down and has given up. At that moment, interruption came from another quarter. It was a shrill cry from the direction of the creek bed, and turning, all three saw a round-shouldered figure on horseback scrambling from the creek bottom, leading the ponies of the two would-be wreckers, and the second cowman running toward him. It's Little Hawk, Alex exclaimed. The cowboy reached the Indian, sprang at him. There was a terrific scrimmage, and the white man sprang from the melee with the bridle of one of the ponies, leaped into the saddle, and was off across the prairie in a whirl of dust. So interested had Alex been in the second conflict that momentarily he had forgotten the man on the ground before him. He was reminded by suddenly finding himself sprawling upon his back, and regaining his feet, found their prisoner also racing off at top speed. The oiler darted after, but quickly gave it up. He was no match for the light-footed cowman. Seeing the pistol still in Alex's hand, he cried, "Shoot, shoot him!" Alex raised the revolver, faltered, and lowered it. "No. I can't," he said. "I can." The oiler darted back and wrested it from Alex's hand. As he whirled about to fire, Alex grasped his arm. "No, wait, look," he exclaimed. "The Indian is after him." Turning, the oiler saw the Indian with his own and one of the other ponies storming across the ground in pursuit of the runner. Silently they watched, as he heard the pounding hoofs behind him. The fleeing cowboy glanced about and set on at greater speed than ever. Quickly, however, the horses cut down the distance between them. The Indian leaned toward the second pony, took something from the saddle horn, and began to adjust it on his arm. "He's going to lasso him," said Alex breathlessly. Nearer drew the Indian to the fleeing man, and hand and lasso went into the air and began to weave circles. Tensely, the two on the embankment watched. Closer the horses drew. Wider the circle of the lasso extended. Suddenly, it leaped through the air like a great snake. The runner saw the shadow of it, and with a cry that they heard, half turned and threw out his arms to ward it off. The loop was too large, the cowman missed it, and as the Indian pulled up in a cloud of dust, he whipped in the slack and the noose tightened, fairly about the renegade's waist. An instant after, however, the second pony, plunging ahead of the Indians, threw the rider forward, slackening the lariat. In a twinkle, the cowman had loosened the noose and was wriggling out of it. He had freed one foot before. The Indian had recovered himself. Then, with a terrific yank, the horseman snapped in the slack the cowman. Feet flew from under him, and with one foot, taut in the air, caught at the ankle, he lay cursing and shaking an impotent fist. As Alex and the oiler ran forward, the Indian sat on his horse like a statue, holding the lariat taut. The oiler reached the prisoner first, revolver in hand. "Get up, you," he ordered. Sullenly, the man obeyed, removing a handkerchief from about his neck. The oiler gave it to Alex, who securely bound the man's hands behind him. Throwing off the lasso, they turned toward the Indian. With some wonder, they saw he was carefully examining the hoofs of the pony he was leading. Concluding the inspection with a grunt, he came forward, winding up the rope, and halted before them. "You hoss?" he asked of the prisoner, pointing over his shoulder. The cowboy looked at him contemptuously and responded, "Well, what if it is old ugly mug?" The oiler brought up the pistol. "I don't know why he wants to know, but you go ahead and tell him," he ordered threateningly. "He's twice the man you are. Is it your horse?" "Yes." Little Hawk turned away with a grunt of satisfaction, and mounting his pony, rode off towards the junction. What the Indian meant, Alex learned when, with their prisoner between them, he and the oiler approached the boarding train and met Little Hawk returning with Superintendent Finnan. "That him?" said the Indian briefly as they drew near. "Him burn cars." From the prisoner came a hissing gasp, as Alex turned upon him with a sharp ejaculation of understanding. However, the man assumed an indifferent air and strode on nonchalantly. "What do you want?" he demanded insolently of the superintendent. "Can a man pull off a little joke without these idiots of yours going out of their heads? It was nothing more than a bit of fun me and my mate was having," he affirmed boldly. Superintendent Finnan smiled sardonically. "That is what the K and Z call it, eh?" Alex, still with a hand on the prisoner's arm, felt him start. But brazenly the man replied, "K and Z, what's the K and Z? A ranch brand, I never heard of it." On a thought, Alex stepped forward and whispered a word in the official's ear. "Go ahead," said the superintendent. "I'm going to search your pockets," Alex announced, stepping back to the side of the renegade cowman. "No objection, I suppose, since you don't know what K and Z means." "Search ahead," agreed the prisoner, half smiling. "And good luck to you if you find anything to connect me, if you find anything," he corrected quickly. From a trouser pocket, Alex drew out a large jackknife. With a suspicion of trembling, he opened one of the blades and examined it, while the owner regarded him curiously. With a shake of the head, the young operator opened the second blade. A quick smile of triumph lit up his face, and delving into a vest pocket, he brought forth a scrap of paper, unfolded it, and took out a fragment of charred pine, shaving, turning his back on the now anxiously watching. Though still puzzled, owner of the knife, he held the shaving against the edge of the blade. The superintendent bent over it and uttered a delighted exactly. Triumphantly, Alex turned toward the prisoner and held the hand with the knife and shaving before him. "Does this help you to recall what K and Z means?" he asked. "Recall, I don't. See these two little ridges on the shaving? See these two little nicks in the blade?" With a hoarse cry, the man flung himself backward, and bound as he was, began struggling like a madman. Alex, the superintendent, and the Indian were to the oiler's assistance in a twinkle, however, and a few minutes later saw the renegade in their midst on the way to the boarding train, and, as it finally proved, to the jail at Exeter. "I don't know who to thank most," said Superintendent Finnan later, "you, Ward, or the oiler, or Little Hawk, nor what appreciation to suggest higher up. You might make it a blanket and Winchester for the Indian and a purse for the oiler for the knocks he got and the bribe he refused," Alex suggested. "And yourself?" "Oh, just let me keep the rascal's knife as a memento," responded Alex modestly. "Very well, we'll agree on that for the present," said the superintendent. XX, a prisoner. When the early morning mail train stopped at Yellow Creek Junction on Tuesday, Alex was at the little boxcar station to greet Jack Orr and Wilson Jennings. Jack, who had not met Wilson before the latter boarded the train at Bonpal, had taken a liking to the Easterner at once and confided to Alex that he was the real goods despite the streak of dude. "We ought to have some good times together," Jack predicted, as with lively interest he and Wilson accompanied Alex back toward the nondescript but business-like-looking boarding train. Jack's hope, as far as it concerned the three boys, being together was soon shattered. As they reached the telegraph car, Superintendent Finnan appeared, and having cordially shaken hands with Jack and Wilson, turned to Alex. "Ward," he said, "I have just decided to send you on to the Antelope Viaduct. A courier has brought word from Norton, the engineer, in charge, that trouble appears to be brewing amongst his Italian laborers, and I would like to get in direct touch with him. The telegraph line was strung within 2 miles of the bridge yesterday and should reach Norton's camp today. How soon could you start?"
"As soon as I have breakfast, sir," responded Alex, stifling his disappointment. "It's 20 miles there, isn't it, Mr. Finnan? How am I to go?"
"You can ride a horse."
"Yes, sir.
Elder will have a pony here for you by the time you are ready, and you had better take an extra blanket with you," advised the superintendent as he turned away. "You will be living in a tent, you know." Half an hour later, Alex, mounted on a spirited little cow pony with a few necessities and a sweater strapped to the saddle and a blanket over his shoulder, army fashion, waved a goodbye to Jack and Wilson and was off over the prairie at a lope, following the telegraph poles. It was a beautiful morning, and with the sun shining and the sparkling air brushing his cheeks and tingling in his nostrils, Alex quickly forgot his disappointment at being so quickly separated from Jack and Wilson, and soon was enjoying every minute of his ride. Keeping on steadily at a hand gallop before he realized he had covered half the distance, he came upon the wire stringing and pole erecting gangs. A half mile farther, a long, dark break appeared in the plain, and a muffled din of pounding began to reach him, and pushing ahead, Alex drew up on the brink of a wide, deep gully from either side of which reached out a great wooden frame dotted with busy men. It was the bed of the old Antelope River, which years before had changed its course, and which the railroad finally proposed crossing with a permanent fill. Directly below, in a group of shrubby trees on the border of the Stony Creek, which alone remained of the river, was a village of white tents. From Alex's feet, a rough trail slanted downward toward it. Giving his pony free rein, he descended. "Where is Mr. Norton?" he asked of a water boy at the foot of the path. "That's him at the table in front of the middle tent," the boy directed. Thanking him, Alex urged the pony forward and leaped to the ground beside a dark-haired, energetic young man bending over a sheet of figures. "I am the operator Mr. Finnan sent on," Alex announced, as the engineer looked up. "Glad to meet you," said the engineer, cordially, rising and extending his hand. "You are a trifle young for this rough work, though, are you not?" he ventured, noting Alex's youthful face. "You are not the operator who caught that K and Z man Sunday."
"I helped catch him," Alex corrected.
"You'll do then," said Norton. "And I'll give you a place here in my own tent," he added, turning and entering a small marquee followed by Alex. "This corner will be yours and the box your office. It will do for the instruments."
"Fine," responded Alex, as the wire stringing gang was not due to reach the viaduct before mid-afternoon. On completing his arrangements in the tent, Alex set out for a tour of his new surroundings. Climbing up the western slope of the gully, he found a large gang of foreigners, mostly Italians, working in a cutting. Judging that this was the gang which was causing the anxiety, Alex paused some moments to watch them. Scattered over a system of miniature track, the men were shoveling earth into strings of small dump cars, which when filled were run out over the completed western end of the viaduct and dumped. As Alex stood regarding the active scene, a string of cars rumbled toward him from one of the more distant sidings. Others had been pushed by several men. This was being driven by a single burly giant. With admiration, Alex watched. Suddenly, a sense of something familiar about the figure stirred within him. The man came opposite, and Alex uttered an involuntary ejaculation. It was Big Tony, the Italian who had led the trouble amongst the track men at Bixton 2 years back, and with whom he had had the thrilling encounter at the old brickyard. When the Italian glanced toward him, Alex started back. But the foreigner did not recognize the young operator with his 2 years of rapid growth and passed on. Breathing a sigh of relief, Alex turned and made his way to the foreman in charge of the gang. "How do you do?" he said, introducing himself. "Who is that big Italian pushing the string of cars?
Alone?"
"Tony Martino.
Best man in the gang," responded the foreman.
"Why, do you know him?"
"He was on a surfacing gang near my father's station 2 years ago," said Alex, "and caused no end of trouble. He was discharged finally." He must have reformed then, the foreman declared. He's certainly the best man we have, more than willing and strong as an ox. He had nothing to do with the trouble you have had here then. He helped me put it down, said the foreman. No, I only wish we had a few more like him.
Alex passed on, thoughtful. At Bixton, Big Tony had been no more remarkable for his willingness to work than for his peaceableness. Had he really changed for the better, or was it possible he was playing possum to cover the carrying out of some plan of revenge against the road? 3 evenings later, a beautiful, moonlit night, Alex left the camp for a stroll to obtain a lookup, and down the old riverbed by the moonlight, he made his way out on the now nearly completed viaduct. As he stood gazing down the ravine to the south, a half-mile distant, a dark figure passed over a bright patch of sand. It was quickly lost in the dark background beyond, but not before Alex had recognized the unmistakable figure and walk of the Italian Big Tony. His suspicions at once awakened. Alex was but a moment in deciding to follow the foreigner, and returning to the eastern bank, he scrambled down to the gully bottom and hastily followed, keeping well in the shadows on the eastern side of the ravine. Reaching the spot at which he had seen the Italian, he went on more cautiously. A quarter mile farther, the ravine swung abruptly to the west. As Alex arrived at the bend, subdued voices reached him. Continuing cautiously and keeping to the deepest shadows, Alex reached a clump of willow bushes. He glanced beyond and, in a patch of moonlight, discovered Big Tony in conversation with an almost equally tall stranger, apparently a cowboy. The latter's back was toward him. The stranger turned and Alex drew back with a start and then a smile. It was the second man of the two who on the previous Sunday had attempted to wreck the track machine, the one who had made his escape. As the man turned more fully and he caught his words, Alex's jubilant smile vanished. Enough to blow the whole thing to matchwood, if you place it right, he was saying. There was no doubt what this meant. They were planning to blow up the viaduct. Oh, I fix it alla right, declared Big Tony confidently. No fear, I USA to dynamite all ariety. I blow up to big at a house once. A house and a big wooden bridge are quite different propositions, and a wooden bridge isn't to be blown up like a stone or iron affair, you know. Suppose you come, taka to look, see my plan all right, den, the Italian suggested. No one on desa side to bridge to see desa time night, the cowman hesitated. Well, all right, it would be best to make sure. We don't want to carry this, though. Where'll we put it? As he spoke, the man leaned over and picked up a good-sized parcel done up in brown paper. From the careful way he handled it, there could be no doubt of its contents. It was the dynamite they proposed using. Here, I find a place. Alex caught his breath at the display of carelessness with which the foreigner took the deadly package. Backing into a nearby clump of bushes, Big Tony stooped and placed the dynamite on the ground, well, beneath the branches. Dara, no one see dat. Come. As the two conspirators strode toward him, Alex crept closer into the shadows of the willows. Passing, almost within touch of him, they continued up the gully and soon were out of sight, before the footsteps of the two men had died away. Alex was sitting upright, debating a suggestion that caused him to smile. With decision, he arose, approached the bush under which the dynamite was concealed, and reaching beneath with both hands, very carefully brought the package forth and placed it on the ground in the moonlight. With great caution, he then undid the twine securing the parcel and opened it. On discovering a second wrapping of paper within, he uttered an exclamation of satisfaction. Lifting out the inner parcel intact, he glanced about and, choosing a group of bushes some distance away, carried the dynamite there and concealed it. Returning, he secured the piece of outer wrapping paper and proceeded to carry out his idea. Where the moonlight struck the western wall of the gully was a bed of cracked, sun-baked clay. Making his way thither, Alex found a fragment a little larger than the package of dynamite and with his knife proceeded to trim it into a square. Carefully then, he wrapped this in the brown paper and wound it about with the cord just as the original parcel was secured, and with a smile, Alex placed this under the bush from which he had taken the genuine package. Dynamite with that as much as you please, Mr. Tony, he laughed as he turned away, when Alex had covered half the distance in returning. To the viaduct, he began keeping a sharp lookout ahead for the returning of the Italian and his companion. He was within 100 yards of the great white structure when he discovered them. Turning aside, he concealed himself behind a small spruce. With no apprehension of danger, Alex waited, and the two men came opposite. Suddenly, without a motion of warning, the two turned and darted toward him, one on either side of the tree. Before Alex had recovered from his astonishment, he found himself seized on either side and threateningly ordered to be silent. they dragged him on some distance, then into the moonlight. "Why, it's one of the fellows who captured Bucks on Sunday," declared the cowboy. "What are you doing here, boy?" he demanded angrily. "I was out for a moonlight stroll," Alex responded, stifling his apprehension. "Why did you hide behind that tree then?" "Well, perhaps I was afraid," said Alex vaguely. "There are some rough people here among the foreign laborers." As he spoke, Alex noted with new alarm that the Italian was regarding him sharply. He turned his back more fully to the moonlight. Immediately, he chided himself for his stupidity. The move emphasized the struggling sense of recognition in the Italian's mind. He smartly turned Alex's face full to the moon and uttered a cry in Italian. "Now I know," he cried exultingly. "I know him before, and he a spy, a boy spy." Rapidly, he gave the stranger a distorted account of the strike at Bixton and Alex's part in his final discomfiture. The cowman listened closely. "Is that so, boy?" he demanded. "Partly, but it was not a strike. It was a simple piece of murderous revenge against one man, the section foreman, and I helped spoil it." "Good, that's all I want to know," said the cowboy with decision. "Not that I care one way or the other about the affair itself. It shows you are a dangerous man to leave around loose. I'll just take you along with me. Come on." "Come where?" said Alex, holding back in alarm. "Never mind, just come," securing a new hold. On Alex's arms, the speaker and the Italian dragged him with them back down the gorge as they neared the spot at which the dynamite was. Supposed to be safely hidden, the stranger halted abruptly, studied Alex intently a moment, then sent Big Tony on ahead after a whispered word in his ear. Alex knew the foreigner had gone to learn whether the dynamite had been touched. In suspense, he awaited the result. Would the Italian be deceived? Would he notice the new footprints about the bush? Big Tony returned. "All right," he announced. Alex breathed a sigh of relief and continued forward with his captors. They proceeded some distance in silence, and presently, Alex had sufficiently plucked up courage to again ask what they proposed doing with him. "I'm going to take you where you will be out of mischief, that's all," replied the unknown cowman. As he spoke, he halted, looked about, and resigning Alex to the guardianship of the Italian, disappeared in the shadow of an overhang of the ravine. A moment later, there was a clatter of hoofs, and he reappeared leading a horse. "Make him read it too?" questioned Big Tony. "Hardly," responded the cowman, at the same time freeing and swinging a lariat from the saddle horn. "He's going to trot along behind me like the blame little coyote he is. Hold out your hands, kid," he ordered. Seeing resistance was useless, Alex reluctantly complied. Running the noose of the lasso about the boy's wrists, the cowman tightened it and secured it with several knots. Swinging into the saddle, he fixed the other end to the saddle horn. "You may go now, Tony," he said to the foreigner, as he caught up the reins and headed the pony toward a path to the surface which Alex had not noticed. "Good a night, Meester Munson, and goodbye, smart boy," said the Italian. "Lucky for you I have Anta my way." "Scrug, that's what you get," he declared, drawing his hand across his throat. "Munson, eh?" murmured Alex as the lasso tightened and he stumbled up the path behind the pony. "That's another good thing learned." Arrived at the surface, his captor halted to look about, then set off across the plains due south at a walk, Alex trailing after at the end of the rope. The situation was not without its humorous side. It occurred to Alex after his first apprehension had worn off, when a few minutes later the pony broke into a slow canter and he was forced into an awkward dog trot, a chuckle broke from him. The man ahead turned in surprise. "Well, you're sure a game one," he observed. "Imagine it's funny, eh? I was thinking how I would look to some of my friends if they could see me here," explained Alex, good-naturedly, trotting along like a little dog on a string. The cowman pulled up and laughed. "Youngster, you're all right," he said heartily. "I'm sorry you're, that is, on the wrong side," suggested Alex, smiling. "Very well, let it go at that. Look here, if I take that thing off, will you promise to come along and not play any tricks?" "Yes, I will," agreed Alex readily, for he saw there was little chance of making his escape from the horsemen on an open plain. "Hold up your hands then," directed the cowboy. Alex complied, and quickly he was free. "How far are we going?" he asked as they moved on, Alex walking abreast. "About 20 miles, replied the cowman, Roman 21, turning the tables. The moonlight had given place to darkness, and Alex was thoroughly exhausted from his long walk when the fence of a corral, then a group of small buildings, loomed up and his captor announced that they were at their destination. "Do you live here all alone?" Alex asked, seeing no lights. "Since you fellows captured Bucks, yes," responded the cowboy, halting at the corral bars, dismounting. He whipped saddle and bridle from the pony as it passed inside and, replacing the bars, led the way to the house. It was a small, meagerly furnished room that a match than a lamp disclosed. Against the rear wall was a small stove, in the center a rough table at either end, a low cot, and in one corner a cupboard. Two or three chairs, some pictures and calendars, and two or three saddles completed the contents. The floor was of hard earth. "That'll be your bunk there," said the owner, indicating one of the cots. "And you can turn in just as soon as you like." Crossing the room, he stood at the foot of the bed, thinking, "What's the trouble? It looks comfortable enough," observed Alex, following. "I have it," said the cowman, and going to the saddles, he returned with a coiled lariat. Alex laughed uncomfortably. "Lie down," the man directed. "Or hold on, let's see first if you have any knives about you." Objection would have been fruitless, and Alex, of his own accord, surrendered his pocket knife. "Now lie down." With what grace he could, Alex complied. Making a slip loop in the center of the lariat, the cowman passed it over one of the boy's ankles and made the holding knot as firm as he could draw it. Then passing the two ends of the rope inside one of the lower legs of the cot, he ran them across the room and secured them to his own bed. "That'll leave you comfortable and put the knots out of temptation," he remarked. "Also, if you start any wriggling, this old shakedown of mine will act as watchdog. It squeaks if you look at it. And I'm a powerful light snoozer and powerful quick with the gun when it's necessary," he added, with an emphasis, which Alex could not doubt. Nevertheless, when presently the cowman blew out the light and retired, Alex only waited until a steady, deep snore announced that the man was asleep. Cautiously, he sat up and reached toward his encircled ankle. The knots had been secured cleverly and tightly. Pry and pull as he could, they gave no more than if they had been made of wire. Working lower, Alex sought to reach the cot leg to see whether it was fixed to the floor. With some difficulty because of the sitting position made necessary, he was straining toward it when suddenly the bound foot lunged from him, the rope tightened, and from the cot opposite came a squeak. The snoring instantly ceased, and Alex sat motionless, holding his breath. The ominous silence continued, and finally he lay back with a movement as though turning in his sleep. Minute after minute passed, and still the breathing of the man across the room did not resume. Then suddenly, it seemed, Alex found himself sitting upright and daylight flooding the room. He had fallen asleep. The second cot was empty, but a moment after the door opened and the cowman appeared. "How did you sleep, stranger?" he inquired. "I thought for a spell last night you were trying some funny business," Alex laughed. "I slept like a log," he declared, truthfully, ignoring the last remark. "Are you going to keep me tied up here all day?" "Until after breakfast anyway," responded his host, proceeding to start a fire in the stove. "Suppose you'll have some bacon and coffee?" "Thank you, yes, I'm more than hollow after that marathon run you gave me last night." As the cowman turned to the cupboard, Alex seized the opportunity to examine the leg of the cot about which the lasso was passed. With disappointment, he discovered it to be a stout post driven into the floor. Despite the discomfort of his position, Alex enjoyed the simple breakfast of biscuits and bacon. He was passing his cup for a third filling of the fragrant coffee when his host abruptly sat the coffee pot down and listened. "Someone coming," he remarked. Alex also heard the hoofbeats. They approached rapidly. There was a step at the door, and a tall, well-dressed figure in riding breeches and leggings appeared. At sight of Alex, he halted in surprise. "Who's this, Munson?" he demanded. The cowman led the way outside and closed the door, and low words told Alex that he was explaining the previous night's occurrences. More, they told him that this well-dressed man was the connecting link between the K and Z and the men who were seeking to interfere with the Middle Western in the race for the Yellow Creek Pass. What would be the outcome of the man's visit for him? Alex asked himself. For the newcomer would not fail to appreciate the disadvantage of having been seen there by the young employee of the MW. The young operator was not left long in doubt. The door again opened, and the stranger re-entered, followed by the cowman, and without preliminary placed a chair before Alex and dropped into it. "Look here, my boy," he began, "how would you like to earn some extra money, a good decent sum?" At once seeing the man's intention, Alex bridled, indignantly. But suppressing his feelings, he responded, "I'd like to as well as anyone else, I suppose, if I can earn it honorably." At the last word, a flush mounted to the stranger's cheeks, but he continued, "Well, that's all a matter of opinion, you know. Every man has his own particular code of honor. However, you probably have guessed who I am, a K and Z man." "Yes, now look here. Suppose the K and Z was anxious to know from day to day the precise progress the Middle Western is making in this race for Yellow Creek, and suppose they were willing to pay $100 a month for the information, would that proposition interest you?" Alex replied promptly, "No, sir, and anyway, it's not the information you want, it's my silence." The man's face darkened. He had one more card to play, however. Well, let it go at that then. And suppose, in addition to 100 a month to keep silent as to seeing me here and what you have learned generally, I should give you. He thrust his hand into an inside pocket and brought forth a long pocketbook. Suppose I should give you, say, $200, cash. Alex caught a knee between his hands and leaned back against the wall. I'm not for sale, he replied quietly. The would-be briber thrust the book back into his pocket and sprang to his feet, purple with anger. Very well, my young saint, he sneered. Stay where you are then till we're good and ready to let you go. He strode to the door, Munson following him. If he tries to get away, Alex heard him add as he mounted his horse, shoot him. I'll protect you. You are a young fool, all right, Munson said, returning. You've simply made it worse for yourself. You've sure now got to stay right here indefinite. And as he ordered, the cowman added determinedly, if you try to make a breakaway of it, I'll sure shoot and shoot to kill. When I go into a thing, I put it through. Alex, however, had no intention of staying whatever the risks, and when presently Munson, after assuring himself that the knots were secure, passed out, he immediately addressed himself to the task of making his escape. It did not look difficult at first sight, since both hands were free and only one foot tied, but an energetic attempt to loosen the cleverly tied slip-loop failed as completely as it had the night before. Likewise, strain as he could at the cot leg, he could not budge it, so firmly was it driven into the hard ground. With something like despair, Alex at last relinquished these endeavors and turned to the problem of cutting the rope in some way, in the hope of finding a nail with which he might pick or fray the lariat. Apart, he made a thorough examination of the cot. There were nails, but they were driven in beyond hope of drawing with his fingers. Dispiritedly, Alex relinquished the search and sat up. His eyes wandered to the window near him. Starting to his feet, he strained toward it. The lower corner of one of the panes had been broken, and the triangle of glass leaned inward loosely. With a low expression of hope, Alex was reaching for it, when from the rear of the cabin sounded the returning footsteps of the cowman. Speedily, Alex sank back on the cot and assumed an air of dejection. A few minutes later, the boy again found himself alone. But in the meantime, he had decided to leave the securing of the fragment of glass and the attempt at escape until night, in further preparation for the attempt. Alex that afternoon stretched himself on the cot and slept several hours. To the young operator, it seemed that the cowman would never retire that night. And when at length he blew out the light and threw himself upon his bed, he apparently lay an interminable time awake. At length, however, when the moonlight in the window pointed to approaching midnight, there came a faint, regular breathing, then a full long snore. Without loss of time, Alex got to his feet at the foot of the cot, and leaning against the wall, reached toward the window. He could just touch the broken corner of pane with the tips of his fingers. Moving his supporting hand farther along the wall, he drew back and reached forward with a lunge. This time he got his wrist on the window ledge. Thus leaning, he finally secured a hold on the fragment of glass with his fingers and pulled on it. A crackle caused him to falter. Munson's breathing continued undisturbed. At the next pull, the piece came free. The next moment, Alex was sitting on the cot end, sawing at the rope with the sharp edge of the broken glass. To his disappointment, the edge, though sharp to the feel, did not cut into the closely woven and seasoned twine as he had expected. Vigorously he sawed away, however, and at last found that the extemporized knife was taking hold, and finally, as the last gleam of moonlight died from the window panes, the remaining strand was severed, and there was a faint slap as the rope fell to the floor. A restless move by the sleeper and a momentary cessation of the snoring gave Alex a thrill of fear. Then the heavy breathing resumed, and getting to his feet, he slipped to the door, found the catch, lifted it, and passed out. As he closed the door, Alex paused a moment to assure himself that the cowman was still breathing regularly, and turned away jubilantly. Exultation over his escape was considerably tempered when Alex discovered that the moon was almost down in the west, and that in addition the sky overhead was clouding. He set off immediately, however, heading straight north, and when a safe distance had been put between him and the cabin, broke into a run. At a steady jog, Alex kept on for several miles over the dimly lit plain. Then the moon finally disappeared, and he fell into a rapid walk. Some time later, he halted in alarm. Was he going in the right direction? On every hand was a wall of darkness, and overhead not a star was to be seen. He moved on and again halted to debate the situation. Certainly, for the time being, he was lost. What should he do? Remain where he was till daylight, or go ahead and take the chance of circuiting back? He decided to continue, perhaps an hour later, still pushing ahead, Alex strode full tilt into a barbed wire fence. As he staggered back, a second cry broke from him. Had he circled back to Munson's corral? His heart in his throat, he felt hurriedly along the top wire to a post and reached upward. A gasp of relief greeted the discovery that the top of the post was well within his reach. The corral posts were not, less than 8 or 9 feet with wires to the top. A further cheering idea followed. On the ride to the Antelope Viaduct, he had noted a three-wire fence, similar to this paralleling the right-of-way for several miles. Perhaps this was the same fence if he only knew its direction. Dropping to the ground for a brief rest, Alex set his brains at recalling every bit of woods or plains, lore he had ever heard or read of for the telling of direction. It was a puff of air against his cheek that suggested the answer, the prevailing wind. What was it here? Southwest. In a moment, he was on his knees at the foot of the adjacent fence post. On the farther side, half covering the dead grass, was a small eddy of sand. Hopefully, Alex hastened to the next post. The same, to make doubly sure, he tried the third, and with an exulting, the same again. Started to his feet and struck on, whistling gaily, confident he was heading due north and that this was the same fence he had seen along the new embankment. A further cheering thought occurred to the young operator presently. The construction train should not be far from the stretch of road which paralleled the fence. Onward he pushed through the darkness at a steady, swinging gait, feeling frequently for the fence to make sure he was not wandering. For what seemed several hours, Alex had been walking, when a faint light appeared in the sky. It was to his right. His plainsmanship had not put him amiss. As the light brightened, he gazed anxiously ahead. The ragged, thin-posted fence stretched unbroken to the northern horizon. He had hoped the light would reveal the swing to the east and the dark shape of the construction train. Alex continued steadily ahead, however, buoying up his lagging energies with pictures of a hot, appetizing meal and a pleasant meeting with Jack and the rest of his friends on the train. And finally, when the sun had been some time above the horizon, he uttered a shout, far in front but distinct in the beautifully clear air. The fence turned abruptly to the east, and less than a mile sunward was a long dark shape in columns of smoke rising lazily into the air. Scrambling through the fence, Alex set off on a beeline for the train, whistling a brisk march. 5 minutes later, the whistler paused in the middle of a note and spun sharply about. The color left his bronzed face. A mile to the rear, on the other side of the fence, a horseman was following him at full speed. A glance at the white-faced pony told it was Munson, and turning, Alex was off, running with every ounce of his remaining energy. The thud of the hoofs gained rapidly. Closer they came, and Alex headed off farther from the fence. Perhaps he'll be afraid to put the horse at the wire, he thought hopefully. He glanced back. The cowman was wheeling off for the jump. In despair, Alex looked over the long mile still separating him from the train, and again over his shoulder. Would the horse make it? He slightly slowed his steps as the animal made the rush. It went over like a bird. Gritting his teeth, Alex dashed straight back for the fence. I'll make him jump his head off before he gets me anyway, he said grimly. Flogging the pony, the cowman endeavored to head the boy off, but Alex reached the wire and dove safely through. Scrambling to his feet, he was on again, this time keeping closer to the fence. It was as the pony drew up abreast 50 feet distant, and while the train was still a good mile away, that the idea of signaling for help on the fence wire occurred to Alex. He acted immediately. Catching up a good-sized stone, he ran forward, and on the topmost wire near one of the posts, pounded with all his might the telegraph dot letters, O, O, or. Munson had pulled up as Alex ran for the fence. When the boy began pounding the wire, he at once recognized its purpose and sprang from his horse, drawing his pistol. Instantly, Alex darted on, carrying the stone. The cowman ran after, but the man was slow on his feet, and despite his fatigue, Alex drew away from him. Stop or I'll shoot, cried the cowpuncher. Pull up, I will. Go ahead and they'll hear you at the train, called Alex, though secretly trembling. The cowman hesitated, then returned the revolver to its holster and ran back for his horse. Immediately, Alex was again at the wire, pounding out, O, O, or. The cowman was again up with him, and once more, he ran on, gazing anxiously toward the train for signs of commotion to show his appeal had been heard. For some distance, the strange race continued, the cowman angry and puzzled on one side of the fence, Alex keeping close to the wires on the other in readiness to dodge under should his pursuer jump. Finally, the rider again swung off and headed in at a gallop. Grimly, Alex halted. With a rush, the horse came directly toward him. waiting until it was. Within a few yards of him, he dropped to his knees and crawled halfway through the fence. It was his undoing. Straight at him, the horseman came as though to jump. Then suddenly the rider, whirled broadside, leaned from the saddle and before Alex, wildly scrambling, could withdraw, had him firmly by the hair. By main force, the cowboy dragged his prisoner through the fence and upright beside him, with a half-stifled sob, Alex lurched limply against the pony's shoulders. "Never mind, kid," said the cowman, not unkindly. "You made a good fight of it, you did your best, but I had to do my best too. If you'll give me your word to go quiet, I'll let you ride behind me," he added. "Promise?" Alex cast a last look back toward the construction train. A few figures were moving about slowly. Clearly, his signals had not been heard. "All right," he said wearily, and with some difficulty, mounting behind the cowboy, they were off the weary way he had come. Jack at the construction train rose late that morning. He had been up nearly all night, awaiting news from the viaduct search party, which throughout the entire day had been scouring the nearby country for his unaccountably missing chum. As he emerged from the telegraph car door, he found the Indian Little Hawk on the adjoining steps of the store car. "Good morning, Mr. Little Hawk," he said. "Sunning yourself? I wait for you. I hear noise, knock," the Indian said. "Knock like little tick-knock in car," he added as Jack regarded him mystified. "Tick-knock, what do you mean?" "On fence," said the Indian stolidly. "Hear 'em twice, like dis." And while Jack's eyes opened wide with a stone he held in his hand, the Indian tapped on the iron handrail of the car the telegraph words, "Oh, oh, or." In a moment, Jack was on the ground before him, all excitement. Where did you hear it?" he cried. "Fence, sleep dar," said the Indian, pointing to the nearby fence. "No tink much about. Den see, horse run, way dar. Den tink tick knock and come, you." Uttering a shrill shout, Jack was off on the jump to find Superintendent Finnan. And 15 minutes later, the superintendent, Little Hawk, and one of the foremen mounted were away on the gallop along the ranch fence toward the point at which the Indian had seen the disappearing horseman. Alex was thoroughly exhausted when he found himself once more at the ranch. Slipping to the ground, he entered the cabin of his own accord and threw himself dejectedly upon the couch. "You've near spoiled a dinged fine rope," observed Munson, following him and kicking at the lariat still stretched across the floor. "Oh, well, I can take it out of the K&Z. Now for some breakfast. Suppose you don't feel too bad to grub, eh, though you sure don't deserve none." As on the previous morning, Alex and his jailer were near the conclusion of the meal when hoofbeats again told of the approach of a visitor. Going to the door, the cowman announced Bennett. "So that's his name, is it?" said Alex quickly. "What did I say? Well, let it go. I don't see that it makes much difference. Yes, Bennett's his name, and mighty lucky thing I have you back here," he added over his shoulder. "Good morning, Mr. Bennett," he said. "Caught us at breakfast again." "Breakfast? What are you doing at breakfast this time of day?" inquired the K&Z man, entering. When the cowman explained, the newcomer glowered at Alex threateningly. "Why didn't you shoot?" he demanded. "Too near the train, they would have heard it," responded Munson. "Well, clear off the table. I have something I want to show you," said Bennett, producing what looked like a map from his pocket. "And you get off to a corner," he snarled at Alex. "Why isn't he tied up?" he demanded of the cowboy. "He agreed to a 24-hour truce, not to make another break in that time," the cowman answered, as he swept their few dishes into the cupboard. Bennett's lip curled under his mustache. "And you believe him, eh?" There was a suggestion of tartness in the cowman. "Prompt, sure. He rode behind me all the way back, on his word not to attempt anything, and kept it. Could have pulled my own gun on me if he'd wanted to." "The more fool," muttered the railroad man as he spread the roll of paper on the table. Alex, meantime, had stepped to the window from which he had taken the fragment of glass and was disconsolately watching a half dozen hens scratching about below. Lifting his eyes, he glanced out over the plain. The men at the table heard a sharply indrawn breath. It was immediately changed into a low whistling, however, and they gave their attention again to the map. Alex had discovered three horsemen heading for the ranch from the north, and the leading pony he would have known in 100. It was Little Hawk, heavily mottled horse, that they were coming to his assistance. That someone had heard the knocking on the wire, he had not a doubt. The horsemen were still some distance out of hearing. Ceasing the whistling, Alex glanced casually toward the table. Seated in chairs, the two men were still deeply engrossed in the plan before them, talking in low voices, when on turning back to the window, Alex recognized the second horseman as Superintendent Finnan. He shot a further glance toward the K&Z man at the table, and a smile of anticipation and delight overspread his face. Then suddenly it occurred to him that in a few minutes, the hoofbeats of the oncoming horses would be heard, and that Bennett would have time to get to the door and escape. He must halt his rescuers and signal them to approach. On foot, a moment Alex thought, then casually remarking to the cowman, "I'm going to open the window. It's hot," unlatched and swung the sash inward. The move passed unnoticed, and leaning out, he pretended to call the chickens. What he was in reality doing was energetically waving his handkerchief backwards and forwards below, making the railroad stop signal. The horsemen came on. If they came much farther, they would be heard. He paused and waved again, more energetically. The third horseman pulled up. Quickly, Alex followed, with the signal to come ahead with caution. The rear pony spurred forward, pulled up beside the second, and apparently at a call, the Indian also halted. On Alex repeating the last signal, all dismounted, and he knew he had been understood. Leaving their horses where they were, the three men came on at a quick walk. Alex continuing to talk to the hens could scarcely contain his secret delight when his rescuers were within 100 yards of the cabin. He once more signaled caution, and they continued stealthily, revolvers in hand. They reached the corner of the house, unheard by the men at the table. The superintendent raised his eyebrows questioningly. Alex glanced over his shoulder and nodded sharply. The next moment there was a rush of feet without, and all in a twinkle Bennett and the cowmen were out of their chairs at the door and staggering back before three threatening revolvers. Staring open-mouthed, they brought up beside the overturned table. Alex's words were the first. "These were the chickens I was calling, Mr. Bennett," he remarked gleefully. The K and Z man recovered himself and turned on the boy, white with passion. He was stopped by an exclamation from Finnan. "Bennett, George Bennett, what are you doing here?" "Perhaps this will explain, sir," said Alex, handing over the map, which he had caught up during the excitement. Bennett made a frantic move to intercept him, but promptly Little Hawk's revolver was in his face and he sank back into a chair, gritting his teeth. "A plan showing every bridge and culvert on our line and directions for blowing them all up simultaneously." "Well," words failed the superintendent. "And this is what you have come to, Bennett? I'd never have believed it." There was a second awkward silence when Superintendent Finnan suddenly broke it with, "Look here, I've got you now, haven't I? I've got you where I can put you in jail for a year or so at least. Well, instead of doing that, I'll make you a proposition. Drop all this kind of work, guarantee that there will be no more of it, agree to make it a straight square building race between your road and mine, the first one to reach the pass to win, guarantee that, and I'll let you go. Do you agree?" Bennett rose to his feet and held out his hand. "I'll give you my solemn word, Finnan, and I'm awfully sorry I ever consented to go into this kind of thing," the K and Z man went on, a quaver in his voice. "But it was put up to me, and when I'd taken the first step, I thought I'd have to carry it through." He turned to Alex. "I'm sorry for the way you have been treated, my lad. You are a plucky boy, and straight, you keep on as you have, and you'll never find yourself in the position I am." I offered him $200 cash and $100 a month to keep his mouth quiet, the speaker explained to the superintendent, and he refused it. "How about the Antelope Viaduct, Mr. Finnan?" Alex asked as they rode away, he on one of Munson loaned ponies. "It wasn't blown up." "No, but an attempt of some kind was made, rather a mysterious affair," the superintendent said. "Late last night, an Italian of the Phil gang was seen stealing to one of the main foundations, then kicking and tearing something to pieces. Norton followed him and found some fuses and fragments of paper that had been wrapped about some strange kind of explosive which apparently had failed to ignite. The Italian has not been seen since." Alex was chuckling. "I think I can guess why that strange explosive failed to go off, sir," he said. "It was clay." And continuing, he explained the mystery in detail. Superintendent Finnan laughed heartily. "Well, Ward, you are certainly due a vote of thanks," he declared seriously. "You saved the viaduct, and now you probably have brought about the ending of the entire trouble with the K and Z people. I'll not fail to turn in a thorough report of it. XXII, the defense of the viaduct, thanks to the termination of the interference from the opposition road, the work on the extension progressed rapidly, and 2 weeks later found the railhead 7 miles beyond the Antelope Viaduct, in the lower slopes of the Dog Rib Mountains. The coveted pass to the Yellow Creek Goldfield lay but 8 miles distant, and as the K and Z was still 20 miles east, it appeared certain that the Middle Western would win the great race. The time had passed uneventfully with the three young telegraphers, the end of the second week finding Alex and Jack together with the construction train at the railhead and Wilson Jennings back at the temporary station and material sightings at the viaduct. Perhaps the last few days had passed least interestingly, with Wilson alone in his little boxcar station, not far from the old riverbed. Saturday had seemed particularly slow, for some reason, and shortly after. 8 o'clock, Wilson threw aside a book he had been reading, and catching up his hat, made for the door for a brief stroll previous to retiring. The moon was momentarily showing through a break in the cloudy sky, and looking to the west, Wilson was somewhat surprised to discover the figures of two men approaching. When, as he watched, they reached the first of a train of Thai cars and leaving the rails, continued forward in the shadows, Wilson stepped back in disquiet. The strangers came opposite and paused, looking toward the station window and speaking in subdued voices. Convinced that something was afoot, the young operator turned quickly and, stooping low that his shadow might not be seen on the window, crept to the little instrument table and reached for the telegraph key. He opened and pressed it down. The sounder did not respond. He tried again, adjusting the relay, and turned about in genuine alarm. The wire had been cut. Some mischief was surely afoot. From without came the crunch of stealthy footsteps. Springing to his bunk, Wilson secured his revolver and belt, the same taken from the would-be bullion thief he had captured at Bompel, and stealing to the rear door, slipped out and to the ground just as the strangers approached the opposite side of the little car depot. The car was raised on a foundation of ties, and as the two men entered, Wilson crept beneath. "No one here," said a gruff voice. "Say, do you, I suppose he saw us and sneaked?" "Like as not. I told you to keep to the rails and come straight up," chided the other. "Perhaps he will come back. We're in charge of the station anyway." That was the real thing. Wilson waited to hear no more. Creeping forth, he stole off toward the ravine, intending to get out of sight in its shadows. A short distance from the head of the viaduct was the green light of a small target switch. The head of the downward path lay just beyond, and Wilson headed for the light. He reached it and passed on. Abruptly, he halted and turned about. Like an inspiration had come the remembrance of Alex Ward, signaling feet 2 years before at Bixton, of which he had heard from Jack Orr. Could he not do the same? Try and signal Alex or Jack at the construction train, say, from one of the boxcars at the farther corner of the yard. Casting a glance toward the little station to assure himself that all was quiet there, Wilson retraced his steps to the switch, removed the lantern, and tucking it under his coat, was off between the material cars. For the farthermost corner of the sidings, the outermost car was a boxcar. Climbing the ladder with his handkerchief, Wilson tied the lantern to the topmost rung, the red light out, and using his hat just as Alex had done, began flashing the call of the construction train. KXKXV. KXKXV. Since the construction train had started from Yellow Creek Junction, it had been a center of attraction to coyotes for 50 miles around, and one of the few recreations enjoyed by the men of the train had been hunting them at night. This Saturday night, Alex and Jack, borrowing Winchesters from other members of the telegraph car party, had set out for a couple of good rugs, as they put it, and on leaving the train had headed east toward the aqueduct, in which direction they had heard barks of the midnight prowlers. They had gone perhaps 3 miles and had fired on several of the wily animals without success, when suddenly Jack caught Alex by the arm and pointed away to the east. "Look, Al, what's that?" "Why, it looks like it's a signal light and calling us KX," cried Alex. "Something must be wrong with Wilson. What'll we do? Back to the train?" "Have you a match and some paper?" said Alex, going hurriedly through his own pockets. "Some matches. Here's a couple of letters. Come on back to the rails, find some chips, and make a fire. See if we can't answer him and learn what the trouble is." They were already racing for the track, reached it, and quickly gathering together a little pile of dry bark and chips knocked from the ties, made a fire at the trackside and lit it. As the flames burst up, Alex threw off his coat and, using it as a curtain, raised and lowered it in a flash. "IIKX," the call twinkled on. Wilson had not seen it, but the next moment, before Alex had completed a second answer, the red light disappeared. Alex again shot forth the gleaming IIKX, and in blinking response, they read, "Chased out of station. Two men, wire cut, something wrong, help, V." "Okay, but we are 3 miles from the train, hunting. Will we come or go back for help?" signaled Alex. There was a pause and the red light blinked. "Come quick." "Okay, coming." Only pausing to stamp out the fire, the two boys were away at a run, heading directly for the light, which at intervals Wilson continued to show as a guide. Their open-air experience of a month had put the two boys in the best of condition, and keeping on at a smart pace, within half an hour the light showed just ahead, and a few minutes after Wilson ran forward to greet them. "I don't know what's in the air, but certainly something," he announced. "As you fellows are armed too, suppose we go back and get the two men in the station car and see if we can't make them tell," he suggested. "Lead ahead," agreed the others. Stealthily, they made their way amid the intervening cars and emerged opposite the little depot. In the window was the shadow of a man smoking. They stole across to the door and Wilson, leading, cautiously glanced within. He turned and held up one finger. Revolver in hand, he tiptoed up the steps and, with a cry, sprang inside and toward the man in the chair. The intruder was so taken by surprise that he tumbled over backward. In a jiffy, the three boys were upon him and had pinned him to the floor, and while Alex closely clutched his mouth to prevent him. Calling out, the others speedily bound his hands and feet with some convenient pieces of wire. Satisfied that their prisoner was firmly secured, and having removed his pistol and cartridge belt, the boys replaced him in the chair and Wilson, pointing his revolver at the man's head, demanded, "Where is your pard? And what are you and he up to?" There was a look of amusement in the man's face as Alex removed his hand and he replied, "Nothing doing, boys, you'll have to guess." "I'll give you three to tell," said Wilson, assuming a fierce expression and beginning to count. The prisoner laughed outright. "You gentlemen, kids wouldn't shoot a fly," he declared coolly. Wilson colored with mortification, for of course he had had no intention of shooting. Even Alex and Jack were forced to smile at the turn of the situation. Wilson had his revenge, however. "Gag him then, Al," he suggested, "and we will stow him away beneath the car." The man's mouth opened for a shout, in a flash. Alex had slapped a handkerchief between his teeth, and despite the man's struggles, stuffed it well in. Then, taking from his neck a long colored neckerchief, he bound it twice about the man's face. "Now out with him this side," said Wilson, opening the rear door. "Wouldn't it be better to take him over under one of the cars on the sidings?" Jack suggested. "His pard might return and he kick or make some kind of a noise underneath." "That's so." Dragging their prisoner forth, they glanced up and down to see that no one was in sight, and with Jack at his feet and Alex and Wilson at his arms, they hastened across the rails, passed between two freight cars, and in the deep shadow beyond placed him on the ground and bound him firmly to a rail. "Be sure you don't talk now," said Wilson derisively as they turned away. "What next?" Jack asked. "It's pretty sure to be some mischief about the bridge. Let's have a look around there," suggested Alex, approaching the brink of the ravine at a point some distance from the viaduct. The boys glanced below. From the three broke a simultaneous low cry of understanding and indignation. In the light of several lanterns, a party of seemingly 15 or 20 men were piling brush about the base of one of the central wooden piers. "The K and Z people again, sure as you're born," exclaimed Alex hotly. "And after their solemn agreement? If they succeed in burning it, they will hold back our supplies 2 or 3 weeks and reach the pass. Ahead of us, dead certain," added Jack through his teeth. "We've got to stop them, boys. Isn't there a handcar or a velocipede here, Wils?" Alex inquired. "No, not even a pushcar, and it'd take one of us an hour and a half to reach the construction train. But that's certainly the only thing to be done," Jack pointed out. "Perhaps two of us with the rifles could hold them." A flicker of light broke out below, which was not a lantern, and approached the dimly disclosed brush pile. Quick as a flash, Jack's rifle went to his shoulder, and there was a reverberating crash. The light disappeared, and there came up a chorus of surprised shouts and the clatter of running feet. "Now we are in for it. I think we had better stick it out together," said Alex quietly. "Perhaps the firing will be heard at the train." The others agreed, and at Wilson's suggestion, they made their way a few feet down the slope to a ledge from which the whole structure of the bridge could dimly be seen. "How are you fellows off for ammunition?" whispered Wilson. "I have 4 more rounds in the rifle and 30 in my belt," said Jack. 5 in the gun and 27 in the belt," Alex announced. Wilson had been examining the revolver and belt they had taken from the prisoner and which he had brought with him. 14 in the 2 pistols and nearly 60 in the 2 belts," he said. "We ought to be able to put up all kinds of a fight," Alex declared confidently. "That is, unless..." He broke off and all leaned forward, peering down into the gloom and listening. From a little to the left rose the clatter of a pebble. Wilson stretched himself on his face and bent over one of his pistols, extended. Barely breathing, they waited, and again came a faint clatter as of loosened earth nearer. "Don't let him get too close," Alex whispered. There came the sound of something snapping, a smothered exclamation, and instantly Wilson fired. There was a shrill cry and the crash of something rolling downward. At the same moment from below came a crashing volley of shots and bullets snarled upward by them like a swarm of bees. The boys shrank back flat, then leaned over and returned 2 quick volleys. Another cry indicated that one of their bullets had found a mark, and following a scattering return volley, from the darkness there were sounds of a hurried scuttling for cover. "Anyone touched?" Jack asked. I think I lost a little hair, said Wilson quietly.
Me too, said Alex.
But a miss is as good as a mile, you know, and we have the advantage so far.
SH, warned Jack.
In the silence came the sound of running footsteps farther up the gully, followed by a continuous rattle of falling stones. They're making a rush up another path. Quick and stop them, exclaimed Wilson, starting to his feet.
Hold on, Alex interrupted as they reached the crest of the slope.
Perhaps it's a ruse to get us away so they can start the fire. You two run and chase them down, and I'll stay and watch here. If you need help, shout.
Wilson and Jack sprang away along the brink of the ravine. 100 yards distant, the sounds of men ascending rose from directly beneath them. Without pause, they fired. Cries of rage followed, and as the boys dropped to the ground, a dozen bullets whined over them. Promptly, Wilson replied with the entire 7 shots from one of his pistols. There was a crash as of someone falling, then a general scrambling, as the entire party apparently tumbled precipitately down the steep slope. Rising to their feet, the boys fired several more shots and hastened back toward Alex. As they neared him, the crash of his rifle told he had guessed rightly that another attempt would be made to light the fire.
Quick, he said, slamming the loading mechanism.
They're sticking to it.
Wilson and Jack saw several twinkling flames, and the roar of Alex's next shot was followed by the crash of their own weapons. A cry of agony followed, and one of the lights disappeared. Another faltered and also went out. Alex once more brought up his rifle, took careful aim. The jet of flame leaped from the muzzle, and with a shout, the boys saw the last spot of light describe an arc in the air and go out. An angry howl followed, then a continuous volley from several different points. The spirit of fight had taken full possession of the three lads on the brink of the ravine, however, and lying close, they gave back, shot for shot, quickly but steadily. Finally, a lull came, and Alex rose exultingly on an elbow and shouted, "Below, come on, you cowards, come!" From behind one of the bridge pillars leaped a flame, and with a sharp intake of breath, Alex slipped sideways. But as Wilson and Jack sprang to his side, he again rose.
"It's nothing," he declared.
"Just a graze inside the arm."
The quiet continuing, the others insisted on removing Alex's coat and feeling found the shirt sleeve wet.
"Tie a handkerchief round it," Alex directed.
"There, that's all right. That's what I get for allowing myself to be carried away, isn't it?" he added as Wilson and Jack helped him into his coat.
"I didn't realize how." All three snatched up their weapons and spun about. A tall, stooped figure was standing within a few feet of them.
"Surrender," cried Wilson.
"Quick, or
it me, little hawk," said a quiet voice.
"Why shoot?"
With a common cry of joy, the boys sprang forward and quickly explained the situation. The Indian grunted.
"Not K and Z man," he said.
"Bad cowboy, miner, gambler from Yellow Creek. Makiam, big bet K and Z win, come burn bridge, Makiam win. Little hawk hear 'em talk, come follow, hear 'em fight, come quick. Think 'em big fight. Only 3 boy fight, eh?" he added in surprise. Alex had been considering.
"Look here, little
hawk," he suggested. "You ride back to the construction train and give the alarm, will you? I think we have these fellows scared now and can hold them till help comes, and none of us could ride that pony of yours."
"I find another hoss, cowboy hoss," said the Indian, pointing the way he had come.
"You go, Takiam, little hawk stay fight."
Alex thought a minute.
"No, I'd rather stick and see the thing through now," he declared.
"Me too," said Jack promptly.
"Same here," Wilson agreed.
"It's up to you then, little hawk. Say, hold on," Alex interrupted as the Indian turned away.
"Boys, how about little hawk taking our prisoner back with him on the other horse? The folks at the train might get some information out of him.
Could you take him, little hawk?" he asked.
The redskin grunted assent.
"Tie him to saddle," he said.
"I'll go and show him where the rascal is," volunteered Wilson. A few minutes later, with the boy's prisoner trailing behind, securely bound to the saddle of the wandering horse he had picked up, the Indian was off across the plain to the west at the top of his mottled pony speed. When Wilson returned to Alex and Jackie, found them busy constructing a miniature blockhouse of ties they had thrown from a neighboring car.
"That's the idea," he said, joining them.
"We could hold out in that all night easily."
"No, leave that opening, Wils," Jack interposed, as Wilson began closing a gap at one of the corners.
"That's to command the bridge. We're going to fire through, not over." The boys had just completed their little fort when from the top of the gully immediately opposite came a spit of flame, followed by the plaintive hum of a pistol bullet above them. Promptly they dropped below the ties, and Alex, who had that side, aimed toward the spot at which he had seen the flash, and as it spat out again, crashed back with his Winchester. From several points along the opposite level, a ragged fire followed and continued intermittently. Then finally, as the boys had half expected, there came a smattering volley from amid the cars on the sidings behind them. The body of their assailants had reached the surface on their side. Now it was that the three began to experience their first real anxiety. For despite their show of confidence, to one another, each secretly knew that if a determined rush was made from near at hand, there was scarcely an even chance of their standing it off. As a provision against this eventuality, Wilson did very little firing during the almost steady exchange of shots that followed, keeping the chambers of his two revolvers always full. To the same end, Alex and Jack used their magazine rifles as single shots, holding the magazines fully charged in reserve. "I think I'm getting one of them now and then," Alex was saying about half an hour after the disappearance of the Indian. "Or else," he broke off to fire again. "Unless their ammunition is giving out over there." Suddenly Jack snapped open his magazine. "Here, they come," he whispered. Alex scrambled about beside him. Wilson thrust the pistol barrels through the loophole, with the boys prisoner securely bound to the saddle of the wandering horse. The Indian was off. Across the plain, from the dark line of the cars rose a shouted command. There came a ripping volley of a dozen Colts, and a dim group of figures rushed toward them. "Now steady," warned Alex, "and shoot low. Fire." Crash, went the Winchesters. Crack, 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 the pistols. Two of the leading runners went to their hands and knees. The others rushed on, shouting and spitting flames. Keeping well under cover, the boys fired as quickly as they could work their weapons. Wilson felt a stinging snip at his right ear and a warm stream trickling down his neck. He emptied the first pistol and began with the second. Crash, crash, roared the Winchesters. The attackers held on. They had made half the distance. In spite of themselves, the boys began firing, nervously. Closer, the running figures came. Jack snapped back his reloading mechanism and pulled the trigger. There was no report. His cry of consternation was echoed by Alex. They had fired their last shots. With a wild shout of triumph, two of their assailants were upon them. From a clear patch of sky, bright moonlight flooded the construction train and the gray slope of the hill to the southeast about which the rails had crept that day. Grouped on the rear steps of the store car, Superintendent Finnan and several of his foremen sat and smoked and listened. "Yes, it's a horse," said one of the foremen. "Two horses," declared the superintendent, "and coming as though Old Nick were after them." Over the moonlit rise swept a figure on horseback, then another. On discovering the group at the car, the leader uttered a shrill whoop and tore down the slope toward them. "The first is Little Hawk. The other is a prisoner. What's wrong?" cried the superintendent, springing to the ground. The Indian pulled up in a cloud of dust before him and threw himself from his reeking pony. "Want Burnham Bridge," he said, indicating his prisoner. 5, 10 more, much more, 3 boy, tick knock boy, fight 'em. Here, here," he placed his hand to his ear. The incredulous group turned to the east and listened, as from infinitely far away, half heard, half felt, came a low, deadened plug, 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 plug. A moment the startled railroad men stared at one another. Then quickly the superintendent spoke. "Ryan, rout out the engineer and fireman. The rest of you run for your guns and a dozen good men from your gangs. Don't lose a minute." The Indian pulled up in a cloud of dust. The group scattered with a rush. 15 minutes later, with men filling her cab and clustered on the tender, the engine was underway, rushing eastward. As rapidly the speed was increased, the locomotive rocked and leaped over the new roadbed, but with the superintendent at his elbow, the engineer drove her up to the last notch, and the prairie streamed by them. Like a blanket, half the distance was made, and above the noise of the engine came a sharp tap, 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 tap. On the engine rushed, and the distant shapes of cars appeared. Simultaneously, there came a crashing volley of shots and a chorus of shouting. The men on the engine gripped their guns and stared ahead into the space lit up by the headlight. With reducing speed, they struck a curve, and the stream of light swung about toward the bridge. The next moment, into the glare broke a group of madly struggling figures. On the flash of the light, the fighting ceased. There were cries of alarm, and the renegades began to break and flee. A small party stood and fired toward the engine. But with a roar, the railroad men leaped and tumbled to the ground and rushed at them, and they, too, broke and fled, and the great fight was over and won. The superintendent was first to reach the little barricade. Jack, he found unconscious from a blow on the head. Wilson had fainted, and Alex drooped limply on the wall of ties, exhausted past speaking. The faces, hands, and clothes of all bore mute witness to the desperate struggle they had put up during those last terrible minutes. Within a short time, however, all three boys had somewhat recovered and were able to take their places in the engine cab, and a half hour later the party headed back for the construction train, coupled behind them a boxcar containing 18 prisoners. 10 of the captured men were found to have been wounded. Several seriously, but to the relief of the boys, none had been killed outright. When rescued, rescuers and prisoners arrived at the construction train. They found an excited crowd of over 300 men awaiting them. And on the details of the affair quickly spreading, the three boys were literally swept from their feet by the enthusiastic foreigners, hoisted into the air, and carried to the telegraph car to a continuous roar of hurrahs and bravos. The following Wednesday, a special train, to which was attached Division Superintendent Cameron's private car, drew up at the rear of the boarding train. Proceeding thither in response to a message, Alex and Jack found Wilson, who had been picked up at the viaduct station, Construction Superintendent Finnan, and several other Middle Western officials. Having greeted them warmly, the division superintendent took a small package from his desk and opened it. "I know you don't like speeches, boys," he began, "and in any case, I'm not sure I could do justice to the occasion. But here, these three gold watches, the very finest the company's money could buy, I may say, will show you what we think of the loyalty to the company and the splendid courage you three lads displayed last Saturday night in defense of the Antelope Viaduct. I might just read one of the inscriptions," he said, opening Alex's watch. "To Alex Ward from the Middle Western Railroad, in recognition of the heroic part he played in the defense of the Antelope Viaduct, November 2, 18, and in thus ensuring the victory of the Middle Western in its memorable race with the K and Z for the Yellow Creek Pass. For that is precisely what it meant," declared the superintendent. "The pass is ours now, beyond any chance. And finally," he concluded, as Alex, Jack, and Wilson, scarcely knowing what to say, took the three beautiful watches, "I would just like to remark that, if you three boys do not someday stand where I stand, or higher, I'll be both greatly surprised and disappointed. That this prediction was justified, you can today learn from any directory of railroad officials. For there, in the pages devoted to the Middle Western, you will find the name of Alexander Ward, Superintendent, Western Division, John Orr, Superintendent, Central Division, and as General Superintendent of Telegraphs, Wilson A. Jennings. End of the project GUTMBRG EBOOK the young RAILROADRS asterisk. Updated editions will replace the previous one. The old editions will be renamed. Creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works, so the Foundation and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the general terms of use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark. If you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research. Project Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark license, especially commercial redistribution. Start full license. The full Project GUTMBRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work to protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg. You agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1A. By reading or using any part of this Project Gutenberg electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property trademark copyright agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8, 1B. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works, even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. C. Paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg electronic works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg electronic works. See paragraph 1E below 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the Foundation or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg electronic works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing, or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The Foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg, 1E1, the following sentence with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to a work with the phrase Project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 or obtain permission for the use of the work and the Project Gutenberg trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9. 1E3. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is posted, with the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the Project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work. 1E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full Project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with Project Gutenberg. 1E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the Project Gutenberg license. 1E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a Project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official Project Gutenberg website. www.gutenberg.org. You must, at no additional cost, fee, or expense, to the user provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original plain vanilla ASCII or other form. Any alternate format must include the full Project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1, 1E7. Do not charge a fee for access to, viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any Project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9. 1E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing Project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of Project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in Section 4, Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that /he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works you provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark works. 1E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing from the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in Section 3 below, 1F1F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe, and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg trademark collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects, such as but not limited to incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright or other intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1F2. Limited warranty, disclaimer of DAMAGES, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, and any other party distributing a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work under this agreement, disclaim all liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no remedies for negligence, strict liability, breach of warranty, or breach of contract except those provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, THE, trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive, or incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1F3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you received the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you received the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing, without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1. F4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth. In paragraph 1F3, this work is provided to you as is, with no other warranties of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to warranties of MERCHANTBLITY or fitness for any purpose. 1. F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1. F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone, providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement, and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur. A, distribution of this or any Project Gutenberg work. B, alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work. And C, any defect you cause. Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org, Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit, 501(c)(3) educational corporation organized under the laws of the State of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. The foundation's EIN, or Federal Tax Identification, number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax-deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516, Montclair, NJ 7042, USA, plus 1-862-621-9288. Email contact links and up to date contact information can be found at the foundation's website and official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact. Section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations, $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state,
visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. Section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the project. Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the U.S. unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper edition. Most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks.